You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Shireen Al-Adeimi, who is originally from Yemen and is an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. She co-authored a recent article at In These Times titled "Trump Quietly Overrides What Little Civilian Protections Remain in Yemen War." Shireen Al-Adeimi, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So, as I recall things, there was a minor scandal when George W. Bush was found to be declaring his intentions to ignore various parts of laws when he signed them into law. And there was a very, very minor scandal when Barack Obama, who had campaigned against that practice, announced that he would continue it and would, in addition, silently rely on past signing statements without even telling us he was doing so. What has been the response now that President Trump is engaging in the very same unconstitutional practice?
Well, there's been no scandal, minor or otherwise. We've not heard about this, about Trump's intention to ignore all the statutes and all the provisions that were included in this signing of the defense bill. So, again, and this is not surprising, I think, given how little the U.S. and media has been covering, mainstream sources have been covering this war in Yemen. People don't even know that we're involved in Yemen, let alone pay attention to, Trump's threat to ignore the stipulations that were put in there about Yemen. But he also, has threatened to ignore other stipulations, for example, the closing of Guantanamo Bay and whatnot. But I think there's a lot of attention on other things related to Trump this time around and not so much some of this dangerous language that he's used in the signing statement.
Right. Presidents are supposed to sign something into law and obey it or veto it, right? And these guys, including the past three presidents on Guantanamo, to take one particular example, all three of them have signed bills into law and said, I'm going to ignore that bit, right? So what, on the recent National Defense Authorization Act, what related to Yemen did Trump say he was going to feel free to ignore?
So I should first start by saying that these provisions weren't going to stop the slaughter in Yemen. I wrote a piece about them, kind of talking about some of the loopholes that they themselves contained. But they were provisions nonetheless, and they were put together by congresspeople and senators who were opposed to this war from the beginning. And they include statements that would have prevented funding from this defense bill to go toward, for example, mid-air refueling. We know that the U.S. is involved in mid-air refueling of Saudi jets, thereby enabling them to stay in the air much longer and to conduct these bombing campaigns much longer than they would have otherwise. But this, there were provisions put in there saying that the U.S. cannot do that unless there was some kind of national security interest involved in there. And, of course, it also gave the Secretary of State the permission to just waive these provisions. So they were weak to begin with, but what Trump did is just ignored them altogether or threatened to ignore them altogether.
Isn't even including the possibility that there could be a national, I assume the nation would be the United States, national security interest in helping Saudi Arabia bomb Yemen, isn't that kind of a giveaway that these people are just going to lie about it and proceed? I mean, how could there possibly be a national?
Right. This country posed a threat to no one. I mean, it's not even capable of defending itself, let alone wage war on a country like Saudi Arabia or the United States. And I think it also contradicts Congress's previous actions. Some members of Congress have tried previously to twice invoke the War Powers Resolution, and Congress passed a bill saying that the U.S. is at war in Yemen without congressional approval. But then here we go, and we create these provisions that do allow mid-air refueling under certain circumstances. And again, it's preposterous to think, Congress should either stand against the U.S. involvement in any kind of way, or you know, not be clear about where they stand rather than include these provisions, which they then allow for, you know, caveats, which would allow for them to just be ignored anyway.
Well, wasn't there also language that said that there must be minimizing of harm to civilians while bombing people's towns in Yemen? I mean, how?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how one would do that, and I'm not sure if it's just sufficient for the Saudi-led coalition to say, yes, we're taking measures and we follow international law, which is what they've been saying. So, for example, the school bus bombing on August 9th, I believe, where 44 children were killed, the Saudi Arabian said, yep, we targeted that bus, and even though the kids in the bus were in summer school and they were between the ages of 6 to 11, the Saudi coalition's official statement stated that, you know, we follow international law and that these the people inside the bus were launching missiles into Saudi Arabia and they got what they deserved. And so, you know, is that sufficient then for the U.S. to say, yep, that's good enough, they're following international law? Because they've been operating with impunity. We wouldn't be here today if the Saudis and the Emiratis haven't been operating with impunity and with cover from the United States and the U.N. and other countries as well who have been participating in this war.
So under the limitations that Trump found too onerous and announced he would feel free to ignore, that might have been good enough for Saudi Arabia to say, yes, we had good reason to blow up a bus full of little boys?
Well, the language is vague. They just said that, you know, if they're showing that they're taking certain certifications required for preventing civilian harm and, of course, the Secretary of State could also issue a waiver to allow mid-air refueling for security reasons. So, yeah, they were weak to begin with, and they allowed the continuation. In essence, they green-lighted these missions, the refueling missions, even if, you know, in essence, they were trying to prevent this. So it's very confusing. It's probably part of this, you know, negotiation that takes place in Congress among senators who really want to end this war and those who don't. But it's been very frustrating.
You know, we're speaking with Shireen Aladimi, whose recent article in These Times was called Trump Quietly Overrides What Little Civilian Protections Remain in the Yemen War. Shireen, I had very strange, very mixed reaction when I saw that story of a bus full of children being blown up and there being video of the children just before they're being murdered, because obviously I thought it was horrible, but I also thought, isn't this kind of a rare opportunity to show people the victims of a war and say, look, here's a emotional reason why you have to stop it, the way that videos of racist police shootings in the United States, for example, have brought something that was known about and happening into people's consciousness through video. Isn't this rather rare to have this sort of footage that you can show people of innocent victims of war?
Well, yeah, I think, and perhaps this is why that particular bombing really captured people's attention here in the U.S. And, you know, CNN went and did an investigation about where this bomb came from, and they traced it back to Lockheed Martin. Well, yes, you know, Yemenis have been doing these investigations and showing pictures of these bombs for years now. And we know that most of them trace back to the United States, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and so on. But, you know, there was a spotlight on Yemen, a very rare spotlight, unfortunately. Despite this not even being the most, you know, casualty-heavy crime, you know, airstrike, unfortunately, there was a bombing of a wedding that killed 40 people. There was a bombing 2 years ago of a funeral that killed 140 people. And these bombings occur on a daily basis. But like you said, we not only saw, and we have footage of the aftermath, but this time we not only saw the gruesome footage of the aftermath and parents really, you know, desperately looking for their children among bodies, but we also saw these kids as they were alive. We saw them, you know, excited, and one of them was filming. We saw them being cheerful and excited about this field trip, which the sad thing is the field trip was to a cemetery. You know, that's another one of those devastating impacts of the war, that there's no green spaces left. And also a lot of these kids have lost many family members in the war. So, you know, we saw them as they were living, and then an hour later they were bombed, and we see these bodies. So I think it's a very you know, interesting and very tragic that they had gone through this. But for us to have that footage, like you said, is rare, and it's a rare opportunity for people to really see the impact of this war on Yemeni civilians.
But it seems that the spotlight has dimmed already, that it hasn't lasted or been as bright as I had hoped. Is there something we can do to make people and make media outlets pay more attention, air this sort of footage the number of times they would if it were, you know, some Washington sex scandal or something that they really wanted us to know about?
Well, yeah, I think the media should be held accountable, because people only really find out about these things when they turn on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC and so on. But they haven't been told about these stories. They haven't been, and when they're told about these stories, they're not told about the impact, about the role of the United States in this conflict. So CBS had ran this, 13-minute segment on the blockade late last year, and not once did they mention that the U.S. party to this to these crimes, that the U.S. is part of this Saudi-led coalition, and that we are the bad guys, really, in Yemen. And so, and I think when people find out about it, they do something about it. So there's hopefully an increased awareness in, you know, people's agency to end this war through legal means. And I think a lot of Yemenis are resting their hopes on the average American citizen who sees these crimes, who sees that these are committed in their name, and who is revolted by them, and who then contacts their senator or their congressperson and urges them to introduce resolutions or support resolutions out there that would extricate the United States from the war in Yemen.
You mentioned that other bombings where we didn't have the same sort of video footage had higher casualties. There's also a cholera epidemic, a famine. I mean, what is the general picture of the damage of this war thus far?
Well, the UN says that this is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and for us to stop and think about what that means, you know, for the average person living in Yemen. Cholera has, it's the worst outbreak in modern history, with over 1 million people who are infected, 1.1 million people infected since April 2017. And the cure for cholera is, you know, rehydrating with clean water. People are dying of cholera because they don't have access to clean water. They're getting sick in the first place because they're drinking contaminated water, and then they're not being treated because of the facilities. They're just not there. When we think about how many people have been killed, the number that's been reported is 10,000, but more recent reports are showing that, you know, tens of thousands of people have been killed, mostly by airstrikes, and that number is closer to 50,000 people. And I think the biggest killer of all is the starvation. You know, the blockade is preventing aid and money and food to come into the country on a regular basis. And also, people just can't afford what little food is entering the country because, you know, the war has just devastated everything, every aspect of life. And so in 2016 and 2017 alone, there were 113,000 children who died from malnutrition and preventable diseases. So these numbers are really staggering. People are, you know, a child can die from a simple bacterial infection because they don't have access to an antibiotic, or, you know, a viral infection, or just, anything really that we take for granted here. A child in Yemen will die from because of the impact of this war.
Yeah. I'm recalling now that there was reporting just recently about the extent to which the Saudis and the United States are both fighting against al-Qaeda in this war and teaming up with and funding and arming and working on the same side as al-Qaeda in this war, somewhat similar to the mess in Syria.
So here's the irony. On the one hand, America, largely under Obama, launched this drone warfare in Yemen where they were targeting people based on suspicion of being part of al-Qaeda. And on the other hand, we have them working hand in hand since the beginning of this war. The BBC and Frontline documented al-Qaeda working alongside the Saudi-led coalition, of which we were a part. And more recent reports have documented, you know, these deals that the UAE and Saudi Arabia do with al-Qaeda, where they, if they want to take over a certain part of Yemen, because they share territory in South Yemen with al-Qaeda, but if they want to have a PR stint and say that we've captured this area from al-Qaeda, then they'll just go and they'll pay them money to move to another area. And Yemenis have known this for a long time. Yemeni reporters have been reporting on this for since it started happening a couple years ago. But we're now seeing documentation by AP and others of the extent of it. And so, yeah, we are essentially working on the same side of Al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Well, I'm not, but you're using we to mean the U.S. military, and I guess it is. I think the propaganda value of Al-Qaeda is tremendous in the United States. You tell people you're fighting a war against Al-Qaeda, you would think the reverse would be true. When people find out that the United States is on the same side as Al-Qaeda, they would turn against the war. Have you found that to be the case, or do people just get confused and block the whole subject out of their minds?
I mean, that part of the war is not being reported as extensively. Now people are starting to become aware that these are U.S. weapons that were targeting the children and that killed the children. But it's still not in mainstream consciousness that the U.S. is on the same side of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And I think, people don't want to see their country or these things happening in their name. And people I've spoken to certainly are repulsed by it and try to contact their congresspeople and senators to get them to act about, essentially this is not a call for any kind of intervention. We want people to end the intervention and foreign intervention, but it's driven them to at least make that contact and to feel like this should not be happening. But it's just still not in mainstream consciousness.
Yeah, I watched a few minutes from the floor of the Senate where Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut was trying to introduce an amendment to the Appropriations Act to effectively cut off money for Trump going ahead with anything in violation of the law, which would seem to make sense. If Congress is going to pass a law, the president is going to say, I plan to ignore that. Congress certainly ought to have the right to say, well, not with any money. And Senator Shelby replied, no, we don't want that to be part of the National Defense Appropriations Act. We want to do that in separate legislation. Is there anyone on earth who thought for a second that he meant that he has some plan to do it in separate legislation? And assuming he doesn't, what options remain to senators who want to do something?
Well, Senator Shelby's biggest donor is Boeing, I believe, and the second biggest donor in the 2016 campaign was Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin provided the bomb that just killed the 44 children in Yemen. And so none of this is surprising. It all comes down to who's making what, how much are people making out of this war and out of these relationships with these big defense companies. And so, no, I don't think anything will happen. Just like when they tabled SJ Res 54 back in March, this was introduced. It was a bipartisan bill that invoked the War Powers Resolution, and it was introduced by Bernie Sanders and a Republican senator, I forget his name now, but he said, oh, let's table this, let's vote to table it, and we'll think about this later, this deserves its own time. And most of the Senate voted to table it. Of course, nothing's happened since then. So, no, they're not just going to pick this back up. And I think the Congress people who are, and senators who are truly against U.S. involvement should be much more ferocious in trying to introduce these law-binding legislations that would end U.S. involvement in Yemen. Senator Murphy has been a great vocal advocate of, ending the U.S.'s role in Yemen, but then he went and voted for this defense bill that was signed earlier this month. So yeah. There's some confusing, and Ted Lieu similarly has said that these look like war crimes and we're participating in them, but then he went as well and agreed to this defense bill that contained these weak provisions that we spoke about earlier.
I thought some people found it even slightly encouraging that vote and the debate that preceded it even happened early this year in the Senate, in that such a thing has happened before in the House under the War Powers Resolution, but never before in the Senate. And it was only a bit more than a majority of the senators who voted for what their colleagues were explaining to them explicitly was a horrific, counterproductive, genocidal criminal act. Do you think that anything has changed so that if such a vote could be forced again, there might be the chance of it going the right way?
Well, I was less hopeful back in March when this discussion happened, because going into the debate, there were 14 co-sponsors of the bill, and they didn't end up voting on the bill itself. They voted to table it. And so 44 senators voted not to table the bill. It doesn't mean that they voted to end U.S. involvement in the Yemen war.
Right.
I would have liked to see how many would have actually had the question been, you know, the bill been presented as is. I'd really like to see, you know, would there be an increase in the number of senators who would say, yeah, we want the U.S. to not be involved in this war in Yemen anymore, which is why I think it's worthwhile to continue to reinvoke these war powers resolutions, frankly, as many times as it takes, because as we're speaking, civilians are dying, and they're dying with our weapons, with our capabilities, with our intelligence, with our refueling capabilities, you know, and so we are causing so much harm to this country that I think the least we could do here for people who are against this war is to try to continuously, you know, invoke. The more they talk about it in Congress, hopefully the better outcomes would be.
It seems, though, that the very best spokespeople in the Senate and the House on this subject and similar subjects talk exclusively about the need for Congress to vote on the war and Congress to legally authorize or reject a war. But I can't fathom any way in which this could be legal under the UN Charter or under the Kellogg-Briand Pact. I think if Yemen were bombing the United States, there's not a single senator who would care whether it was a Yemeni president or a Yemeni legislature behind it. They would simply see it as a crime. And so I wonder about all this talk about properly bombing Yemen without war crimes. Isn't the entire thing a crime?
Absolutely. You know, I was on a radio show earlier last week with Stephen Rapp, who is former U.S. ambassador for war crimes issues and former chief prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And he recently wrote a piece called Time for a Reckoning in Yemen. And he spoke about the fact that people have been prosecuted for war crimes for just being providing support to countries that were committing war crimes. They didn't have to know about it. They don't have to know that these war crimes are happening. They just have to provide. They just have to have, you know, provided substantial aid to the people who are committing war crimes. And so he said, unfortunately, the U.S. Nobody has any jurisdiction over the U.S. There's no ICC jurisdiction over the U.S. or any of the countries involved in bombing Yemen. But had there been jurisdiction, they could definitely be tried for war crimes, given what they're doing in Yemen.
The ICC has claimed to be investigating U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan, whether you believe it or not, on the grounds that Afghanistan is a member of the ICC and therefore there's jurisdiction to go after the United States in Afghanistan. Is Yemen not a member of the International Criminal Court, and might it make sense to consider quickly becoming one?
I'm actually not sure. I can't remember if President Hadi has stayed in the ICC or not, you know, that if somebody has jurisdiction over these war crimes, I mean, certainly people have been committing them left, right, and center in Yemen, UAE, Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. Through the support which it provides these countries.
Yeah, but getting back to Trump openly ignoring laws passed by Congress while engaged in a criminal enterprise that's illegal under treaties the United States is party to, even if his predecessor was doing the very same thing on a different scale, how is that not quintessentially an impeachable offense? And if Congress can't stop the president and won't cut off the money, I mean, how could there be better grounds than that for Congress impeaching and removing a president that won't comply with the law?
You know, I'm just not sure really what Congress is doing. The defense bill passed 359-54 in the House and 87-10 in the Senate. So they passed overwhelmingly and very quickly. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren was one of 10 senators who had voted against it. And she recently asked for clarification about the U.S.'s role. Well, how much more clarification do we need? How much more evidence do we need that the U.S. is involved in Yemen, that the U.S. is providing support to the Saudi-led military, which is committing egregious war crimes? I mean, there's just no question about the extent of U.S. involvement in Yemen. The army brags about it and posts, you know, tweets about how much involvement they have with the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. And so I just am not sure that Congress can just continue to issue these, you know, challenges or whatnot when they go on and then vote for these bills. I think if they really are serious about ending the war on Yemen, they would. And the war is a legal means. And if they're serious about impeachment, they would follow through with some of these moves. But I'm just not seeing, I just don't know if it's just all political games or if people are really serious about ending it.
So what can people in the United States and in the other 96% of humanity who care about blowing up busloads full of little children and creating epidemics of famine and cholera and violence do? Are there international bodies that can do anything? Should nations and groups and organizations around the world be boycotting, divesting and sanctioning the United States and Saudi Arabia? What can be attempted?
I mean, that's ideal, but I don't think it would ever happen because the UN acknowledges that the Saudis have the right to intervene in Yemen. And they've treated Saudi with, you know, with a lot of care because they get a lot of money from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has previously threatened to pull funding from the UN when they put them on the list of child killers, and then Saudi, you know, or the UN pulled them out of the list of child killers. When they were attacking Hodeidah a couple months ago, the UN said, no, do not attack Hodeidah. This is a red line. Saudi said, no, we'll attack it anyway. And the UN pulled all of its staff from the city. So they just kind of go whichever way Saudi Arabia, you know, decides. And so I don't think there's hope for Yemenis with international organizations like the UN. Certainly the U.S. has been providing cover for them at the UN. And even when countries have attempted to, you know, put forth proposals for independent investigations, there's been pushback. And every time the Saudis are essentially allowed to investigate their own crimes. And, of course, they then go on and absolve themselves from these crimes. But I think we just have to look at the reality that a lot of people are making a lot of money from this war in Yemen. And so citizens really have to, you know, challenge the people representing them in their government, whether here or in Canada or the UK, and you know, challenge this notion that we're making money out of dead children.
Yeah.
And when is that going to end? Well, it only ends when the U.S. pulls all of its support the Saudi-led coalition. The Saudi-led coalition will not stop. This is an ego fight for them. Emiratis won't stop. And so, but because they don't manufacture their own weapon, they don't advise their own soldiers, they don't have their own mid-air refueling, they don't have their own targeting, they rely on the U.S. for all of these services. The only hope, really, is to end this war is for the U.S. and other countries to pull to end their support of the Saudi-led coalition.
Very well said. Wish we could go on. Shireen Al-Adeimi, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media cover electoral politics a lot. Yet the questions that guide that coverage don't seem to change much. Who's leading in polls before anyone's learned much about the candidate's ideas? Who said what awful thing about their opponent? Who's raised more money from rich people? That's not the same as covering the electoral process. Do elections represent the public will? Does everyone who wants to vote get to? How can we ensure that our voting process reflects the principles of democracy that are so insistently invoked? There are a few questions more critical right now. We'll talk about them with John Powers, counsel in the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Also on the show, when you think school safety, you may think about the Parkland shooting, or Sandy Hook, or Columbine. Certainly that would be the media context in which the phrase occurs. But policies and practices based on that definition of safety end up making kids, particularly kids who are black and brown, or LGBTQ, or disabled, less protected and less secure in school. A new report from the Institute for Policy Studies, Students Under Siege, outlines how that happens and how alternative definitions of safety lead to better outcomes for kids, their families, and schools. We'll speak to the report's co-author, Karen Dolan. She's director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. All of that's coming up, and I think we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. So many reporters swarmed into the tiny town of Cuthbert, Georgia. A county attorney told Rolling Stone's Jamil Smith it filled up the Econo Lodge. The subject of the media scrum, which it should be noted followed community outcry, was a political consultant's plan to shut down 7 of 9 polling places in an overwhelmingly black and low-income county on the pretense that they were inaccessible to people with disabilities, a concern he appears only to have developed after Stacey Abrams, a black woman, was nominated for governor. The Board of Elections of Randolph County voted down the outrageous proposal. But for many, the ham-fisted maneuver stands as a warning of how far and how low some will go in trying to suppress the votes of the black, brown, and poor. With critical elections on the horizon, there's never been greater need for scrutiny of the voting process in this country and the efforts to disconnect it from anything like real democracy. John Powers is counsel in the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. He joins us now by phone from Atlanta. Welcome to Counterspin, John Powers.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, the Georgia shenanigans have their particulars. It wasn't an official who tried it, but this consultant that the county brought in and has since fired. And the Board of Elections voted it down following normal procedures. It was never a done deal. But I have to believe that the outcry and the spotlight were salutary, even if it overwhelmed this little town, for exposing voter suppression, which can take many different forms, can't it? It's not just as simple always as shutting down polling places.
That's right. The voting process is, in the United States, a lengthy one, of course. You have to register. You have to figure out which voting precinct and polling place you're in, assuming that your registration application is actually approved by the Board of Elections. Then you have to decide to vote either by absentee ballot or early voting in person at a location or on election day. And the sad truth is that there are jurisdictions around the country that have made it more more difficult for people to vote at each and every stage of that process.
Well, I want to draw you out on one particular aspect of this. So someone who hasn't voted in a while because they haven't been moved to or because their situation meant that they couldn't, but now they want to vote and they find they've been erased from the rolls. Can you explain purges?
One thing that a lot of voters aren't aware of with respect to their registration status is that it's not necessarily permanent. If someone voted, say, for former President Obama in 2008 or 2012 and haven't voted since then, they may no longer be on the list, even if they haven't moved from their house since then. The Supreme Court decided in the Ohio case, Husted, that a voter can be placed in an inactive status and then ultimately removed just for not having voted in the past number of election cycles. So voters have to remain vigilant to make sure that they are on the list and may have to take additional steps, even though they haven't done anything to take themselves off the list if they haven't voted in a while.
Well, it seems anti-democratic on its face. You know, you haven't voted, so you can't. But I understand these purges are also flawed in practice.
There's a lot of problems with how these systems are set up. For example, if a board of elections can flag someone to be purged if mail sent to them is returned as undeliverable by the postal service, or if the board of elections receives other information indicating that the voter may have moved, even though that's not actually true. The board of elections will then send you a little postcard that looks like a piece of junk mail. If you don't fill that piece of mail out and return it, the Board of Elections takes that as you admitting that you no longer reside at that jurisdiction, and then you can be removed within a couple of election cycles. And most people don't realize that notice means that, and therefore they don't fill it out, which is why so many folks get removed improperly on the basis that they move.
I understand that these purges are increasing lately. I think there's new research from Brennan that suggests that. Can you explain briefly what things like this have to do with Shelby County versus Holder, the 2013 Supreme Court decision? A lot of this is connected in one way or another with that ruling, isn't it?
It is. In 2013, the Supreme Court rendered an extremely important opinion in Shelby County v. Holder, which lifted many jurisdictions across the country from having to submit changes to their voting practices and procedures for what was called preclearance or review by the Department of Justice. And that preclearance process forced jurisdictions to be really careful about the voting changes they enacted and submitted for review because they were prohibited from adopting changes that either had a discriminatory effect on minority voters or was adopted for the purpose of making it more difficult for minority voters to cast a ballot. And what we've seen since the Shelby County versus Holder decision is that jurisdictions no longer being monitored and having to submit things for review have said, okay, now we're free. We can do whatever we want. And that places an extreme burden on local voters and nonprofits to challenge things at the local level and, if necessary, bring lawsuits, so meaning that things that before could have easily been stopped in its tracks by DOJ at the outset now get through, and it requires for example, in Georgia, there are 159 counties. It's hard for community activists to stay engaged and fight in every single county in a state, you know, let alone the entire country.
And I would just point out, states weren't chosen randomly to have to pre-clear their election laws. They were particularly those places that had a history of racial discrimination, right?
That's exactly right. The states subject to Section 5 pre-clearance had been chosen for that specifically because they had a track record of discrimination leading to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in the first place. And what we've seen is that since Shelby County, it is these states where we've seen the number of problematic voting changes increase rapidly in recent years. You could go through a laundry list of voting precinct consolidations, purges of voters, enacting very draconian exact match registration requirements where people get booted off the rolls for having a hyphen in their voter registration application, but not on their driver's license, as well as proof of citizenship requirements. There's a number of different barriers that have been erected that make it more difficult for minority voters to have an equal say in the political process.
Well, let me read you a quote. The New York Times, in reporting on the Supreme Court's upholding of the Ohio Republicans' plans on purging, the Times called it, quote, "a vivid reminder that measures placing obstacles between people seeking to vote and their ability to cast ballots, including cutbacks on early voting, elimination of same-day registration, and tough voter ID laws, present dueling visions of democracy. Republicans have pushed for such restrictions, arguing without evidence that they are needed to combat what they say is widespread voter fraud. Democrats have pushed back, countering that the efforts are part of an attempt to suppress voting by Democratic constituencies, particularly minorities," close quote. Corporate media have been, I think, increasingly willing to say, as the Times does here, that claims of voter fraud are unsubstantiated. But to present the idea that they represent voter suppression as a counter to that, as if it were equally groundless and partisan, you know, to call them dueling visions, I think is journalistic malpractice, frankly. What are your thoughts, finally, on what responsible reporting on voting, on these important voting issues, would include? What would you like to see from media?
That's a very good question. You're absolutely correct that the media has played a game of false equivalence when it comes to reporting on the battle for voting rights in America. And the simple fact is that jurisdictions that have wanted to disenfranchise voters have been raising the specter of voter fraud for more than 100 years now. Tools like the literacy tests, grandfather clauses, poll taxes were justified on the grounds of protecting the integrity of the ballot box and preventing voter fraud. And these rationales are just as specious now as they were back then. There's been exhaustive studies in Texas and Georgia and North Carolina where government officials have spent large number of taxpayer dollars hunting for voter fraud, and they simply can't find it. You either see no criminal charges or convictions whatsoever, or the criminalization of innocent behavior in which poor voters who are not aware of the significance of their actions end up getting prosecuted for making innocent mistakes. So that's what you have on one side of the ledger. On the other side, you see the enactment of legislation and pursuing practices, whether it's strict voter ID, proof of citizenship requirements, exact match voter registration verification procedures, the use of cross-check between the various states, reducing the number of early voting locations and election day polling locations, a whole panoply of practices that have had tangible, measurable effects in terms of reducing the number of people who have been able to participate in the political process. And, of course, creating these burdens has the most significant impact on our country's most vulnerable citizens, who happen to generally be those from a lower socioeconomic status and education level and income level, and who have greater burdens in their lives that make it more difficult to jump through the extra hoops that have been placed in front of them. And to say that the thousands of voters who have been disenfranchised, or when it comes to gerrymandering and redistricting, whose actual votes mean less because they've been placed into cracked or past districts, to put that on an equal footing with so-called ballot integrity and preventing voter fraud is a grievous mistake. And hopefully going forward, the media will look at the hard science and the data and be more willing to call out attempts at voter suppression for what they really are.
We've been speaking with John Powers, counsel in the Voting Rights Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. You can find their work online at lawyerscommittee.org. John Powers, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Nothing says America 2018 like a spate of stories on how back-to-school shopping includes bulletproof backpacks. Arming teachers and gearing kids up like commandos are presented as more or less reasonable responses to concerns about school safety. Any violence in schools is too much, of course, but a conversation about school safety that's focused on guns and bullets is a narrow and distorted conversation. Recasting our definition of a safe school environment could lead us in some very different directions. Karen Dolan is director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author with Ebony Slaughter Johnson and Mayaka Sampson of the recent report, Students Under Siege: How the School-to-Prison Pipeline, Poverty, and Racism Endanger Our School Children. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Karen Dolan.
Thank you, Janine. It's a pleasure.
Well, take us through what you see as the most salient observations in this report. What were you looking at, and what did you find?
Well, we were looking at the ways in which children can have the most support and the best chance at the best life. And while we are doing this work and this research, the Parkland shooting happened, of course, and it has been in the news a lot, gun violence and school shootings, which, of course, endanger our public school students. But at the same time, there's a larger number of students, there's millions of students who are also being endangered simply by having their future cut short by excessive expulsions, suspensions, referrals to the criminal justice system, lack of proper supports in school for academics, for social and emotional learning, and for well-being. And as we hear the discussions on the airwaves, as we read it in the newspaper, as you said about going back to school and the Education Department suggesting that we take money away from student supports and put them into arming teachers and putting more cops in the hallways, it's really exactly the wrong thing that we should be doing. And what we would like to do is to see the debate broaden into looking at safety measures in a deeper, more holistic way as our students return to school.
Well, when you say it's the wrong thing to do or the wrong direction, that has to do with the impacts of these punitive, get tough school policies that people often say are aimed at safety, but the fallout from them falls out in certain kinds of ways.
Well, that's right. So the impacts can be very devastating and very long term. So you see everything from a child having one suspension doubling their chances of dropping out of high school, which will affect them for the rest of their lives, to schools that have these school resource officers who are indeed law enforcement officers armed, that these schools that have the presence of school resource officers have about a five-time greater instance of referring children to the juvenile legal system. So these are very deep and lasting impacts on children for the rest of their lives, not to mention on their families and their communities at the time that it happens and on the schools themselves.
Well, obviously, the reason for the concern, the heart of it is, as you say, the impact on the lives and the education of kids. But I want to underscore that this report is about facts and not feelings. You know, it draws on statistical data to tell a story of what's going on and the way these things actually affect folks.
That's right. So all of the evidence really points to the ways in which students are harmed this way, and their earning power and their graduation from school are negatively impacted. And we find that the children who are most affected are children that are from poor and low-income families, children with disabilities, Black children, immigrant children, Latinx children, LGBTQ children. So children who already have had an historic marginalization in one way or another are feeling the impact even greater in schools that employ these kinds of tactics and these kinds of punishment that further put obstacles in their path of being able to have a safe childhood and thrive as an adult.
Well, nobody says, you know, we think Black and brown, and especially poor Black and brown kids, should just get used to being policed, you know, being treated as potential criminals, because that's how we view them. You know, that's not what they say. The claims are about safety and security, presumably as these relate positively to education. So it should matter if you can show that these practices do not, in fact, increase safety. You know, that should have an impact. And for those who are not ideologically committed to punitive discipline, there are alternatives. And I just wanted to ask, you know, what does the report have to say about other approaches to school safety?
That's right. So there are alternatives that have been proven to be effective, whereas these other punitive discipline and zero tolerance policies have proven to be detrimental and destructive to children, not just the children who are being disciplined, but the whole community and the whole school.
Mm-hmm.
So on the other side, schools that undertake restorative justice practices, restorative practices in their classrooms or as a whole school, schools that are using social and emotional and academic development within their curriculum, where they're looking at the whole child, they're looking at the circumstances in a child's community or a child's family. They're involving family, involving community. They're involving the children in the way that they are, that they can best learn and best be supported. And looking at discipline rather than retributive or punitive, looking at it as a harm has happened. How do we restore that harm? How do we make our community whole again? It still includes accountability. But what it does is it involves all of the stakeholders in the harm that has been done, and this has been shown to vastly reduce recidivism and to increase the satisfaction on the part of the person to whom harm has been done, and accountability on the part of the student who has done harm. So when you look at these holistically all together and you look at the results, that they have a much more positive results, you know, from A to Z, it's almost impossible to see how anybody would disregard using these practices that are proven to be positive versus the punitive zero tolerance discipline, which has proven to be detrimental.
Well, this is a little bit outside the report, but I wonder if I could ask if you think Betsy DeVos, as Secretary of Education, has she behaved in sort of the way you'd anticipated with regard to this set of issues? And what do you think the impact of her tenure might be, or the direction that she's sort of pushing things from the top down as Secretary of Education?
Well, I think she's been an unmitigated failure with regard to protecting students. I have sat down with her face-to-face around some of the LGBTQ issues, and her department has rescinded most of the protections and guidances that have been put in place to address some of these issues that we know are issues. So the Education Department has declined to exercise oversight and has made it clear that they won't intervene when there are problems with discrimination and overly harsh punitive processes, and now have proposed to take funding from these very supports for children and put them instead into purchasing guns for teachers who don't want them.
Well, it really even when things don't become law, they send a clear signal all the way down, don't they, that folks respond to?
That's right. There's almost no recourse at the federal government right now.
Well, let me ask you what you see as media's role here. Certainly, sensationalist coverage of what school shootings do occur is not helpful. But in terms of the broader set of issues, are there things you'd like to see journalists digging into? Is there anything you'd like to see more of or less of on the part of media?
Yes, I'd certainly like to see them cover more things like what we're talking about in this report. Cover more the positive results from social and emotional learning, from restorative justice. It's happening in communities all across the country. You know, really talk about this when you're talking about safety. Don't just talk about the physical aspect of what is still relatively rare occurrence or mass shootings in schools, but really what's happening on a broad scale around the country, what really endangers children in their day-to-day lives at school. I think that the media would do very well to take a look at that and really report the facts of what's happening.
And maybe step outside of casting it as some sort of partisan issue. You know, right wing thinks this, other left wing thinks that. And, you know, if you put kids and actual facts at the center of the conversation, it probably would change it.
Well, that's right. I don't think that anybody deep down feels that the safety of our children is a partisan issue. It's a matter of understanding what the word safety means in a holistic way for the well-being of our children and their future.
We've been speaking with Karen Dolan, director of the Criminalization of Race and Poverty Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can find the report, Students Under Siege, on their website, ips-dc.org. Karen Dolan, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire. I take you to burn. Fire. I take you to learn. I'll see you now.
Welcome to hot summer programming from Radio EcoShock, at least for those in the Northern Hemisphere. I'm Alex Smith, bringing together some of our best recordings and interviews. This week and next, we'll focus on the growing trend of monster forest fires, what one guest calls the age of superfires. I feel personally involved. As I prepare this show, it's 111 degrees Fahrenheit, or 44 degrees Celsius, in the shade outside my radio studio, for the second time this week. What should be the wet West Coast is tinder dry. Hundreds of fires have sprung up all along the West Coast of North America, from California to Alaska. More than a dozen started within 50 miles of my home in the past few days, and the big summer fire season is still ahead of us. Even if it's cold and rainy where you are, the impacts of global forest fires affect the health of millions, kill many. It affects the economy, and it acts like a positive feedback loop to increase the speed of global warming. Next week, I'll interview scientists and fire experts on the new superfires. This week, I'm replaying three key talks I recorded at the annual conference of the American Association for the Advancement of Science held in Vancouver, Canada in February 2012. We'll hear about the global fire situation and the health impacts of fire smoke, including how you and your community can prepare for it. This is Radio EcoShock from April 18th, 2012.
Radio EcoShock.
It's time for the Radio EcoShock special, my recordings of a session on fire and climate. The fire experts gathered at the February Conference of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver 2012. You'll hear how fires make a hotter climate, which feeds more fires, the cycle of positive feedback. An internationally recognized wildfire expert, Dr. Michael Flanagan, reports on the latest science and experience in the field. Flanagan also describes a new risk that could tip the climate of the world. You may have a personal stake in this. Anyone with lungs does. From the University of British Columbia School of Medicine, Dr. Michael Brower explains new ways of tracking dangerous smoke, which can travel thousands of miles across international boundaries. I like Brower's talk because he also tells us how citizens can protect themselves during a smoke event. Finally, we'll hear from Dr. Faye Johns from the University of Tasmania. She was part of a team asking the big question, how many people die every year from fire smoke? The answer, and the places most at risk, may surprise you. Let's get the big picture from one of my favorite wildfire experts. Dr. Michael Flanagan is a professor at the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. He's the senior research scientist at the Canadian Forest Service. His PhD is from Cambridge, and he's trained in meteorology. Flanagan is editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Wildfire and part of the U.S. Assessment on Global Change. Mike is a leader in the newly formed Western Partnership for Fire Science. We're going to hear excerpts from my recording of Mike Flanagan's presentation at Forest Fires in Canada, Impacts of Climate Change and Fire Smoke, delivered Sunday morning, February 19, 2012, in a special workshop at the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver.
So, what do we know about fire on the landscape across the globe? Well, about, and I do say about, 350 to 450 million hectares burns every year. And for context, that's the size of India. We have no clue as to how many fire starts there are in the globe, but we guess that about humans are responsible for 90% of them. The largest area burns are in grasslands and savannas. In many ecosystems, fire is a necessary component. You'd see lots of fire in Africa, Australia, and Southeast Asia, and less so in Siberia and Canada, United States, and a fair bit of fire in the Amazon as well. So let's talk about people and fire. It's a two-way street. Humans impact fire, land use change, clearing, abandonment, building cities. We try to manage fire. Some places it's truly fire suppression. Some human-caused ignitions are accidental, but some are deliberate arson fires. And arson fires seems to be on the rise. And of course, the flip side is fire impacts humans. Loss of life, infrastructure, evacuations, air quality, which we'll hear a fair bit about, water quality, fire suppression costs, indirect effects like climate change, and ecological aspects like biodiversity. Now, fire management globally, there's a wide range from the most sophisticated computer-aided decision support, helicopters, to using brooms for fire management. So a wide range of activities. Many billions of dollars are spent. In Canada, we're averaging about $800 million a year, though this year, or 2011, we went over a billion. The United States is several billion. California alone usually spends a billion or more. Fire management is replacing fire suppression in some regions. It's a balancing act between protection of human life and values at risk and protecting the environment and the ecology. So this is how I view the world of forest fires or wildland fires. There's four key factors. And really what I'm looking at is not an individual fire, but looking at fire over a landscape over a period of time, say a couple of weeks to a month to a season. And these ingredients or factors are fuel, how much fuel, how moist it is, how it is structured. If it's a forest, does it have ladder fuels that's understored to carry the fire from the surface to the crowns? You can't have a fire if you don't have ignition. And there's two primary types, human and lightning. And of course, there's weather. And I unabashedly think that weather is the most important factor. Things like temperature, precipitation, atmospheric moisture, upper conditions, blocking ridge or mega blocks, solar radiation, and there's climate patterns like ENSO, Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation also influences fire activities. And last, the first three are natural factors and would operate if there was no people on the landscape. The last one are people, but we are on the landscape and we fragment and we manage fire, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what's interesting here is that weather is a component of the first three in that fuel moisture is a critical consideration and fuel moisture is directly controlled by the weather. Also, lightning, one of the ignition factors, is also controlled by the weather and weather is its own factor. So in terms of options, if these are the things that are driving fire, what can we control? Well, we can't really control the weather. So the only options are fuel and human-caused ignitions. So we should be spending more time on prevention, education, restricted fire zones, reduce or eliminate industrial activity during periods of high fire danger. And we can modify the fuel. And programs like FireWise, FireSmart already doing that. Fuel breaks, changing the fuel load, fuel type, at the landscape level, which probably isn't too effective, or near areas of high value like communities. So now we're going to talk about climate change. And the GCMs predict temperature changes of 1.4 to 5.8 degrees Celsius by 2100. Greatest increases at high latitudes over land in winter and spring, though over the Arctic Ocean, because the ice may be seasonal by mid-century, there will be significant increases in temperature over the Arctic Ocean. Projected increases in extreme weather, heat waves, droughts, floods, windstorms, ice storms, etc. And the two graphs here, one is showing observed temperature, and this is from a while ago. It just shows temperature change per decade, and the warmer yellows and oranges are warming and the blues are cooling. And you see a pattern that not everywhere is warming, but over land, northern areas. And I compare that with projection from the Canadian model for 2050. And you see a somewhat similar pattern to what's happening. And once again, it's warming, in some places, significant warming over the Arctic Ocean because the ice is probably seasonal now. But there are areas where there's no change or cooling, and that's due to ocean currents. So a big part for fire is variability. And it's because fire is usually a result of extreme. Just a few critical days are responsible for most of the area burned. Sometimes you have fire and then you have a flood because you have increased runoff. Other parts of the world, you have floods and then you have fire, like Australia, the central dry area. You have flooding, which increases production of vegetation, which then dries out in the next dry spell and then burns. And things like wind, the projections are for most regions, the average wind speed is not going to change a great deal, but we expect to see more extreme wind speeds in the future. And those are the days when the fires spread. And those are the days we have to watch for. So if the extremes are increasing, even though the average isn't, we still have a big problem. And by 2100, it's a much warmer world, according to this simulation. Temperatures of 5-6 degrees warming, which is a very significant warming. You do see areas, once again, a little change or perhaps even a little bit of cooling, southern oceans and near Labrador. But it is a much warmer world if these models are anywhere close to reality. This is work done by Nathan Gillette back in 2004, and he looked at area burned in Western Canada. And is it changing, increasing? In that paper, we suggest that the increase in area burned we've seen in Canada, which has been a doubling already, is due to human-caused climate change. So one of the key factors in this increase in fire that we've seen already in Canada and in other parts of the globe, and what we expect to see in the future, is because of increased temperature. And, you know, I get asked, well, why is temperature so important? Well, there's three reasons. And the first is that increased temperature drives evapotranspiration, which drives how dry the fuels will be. Generally, the fuels are going to be drier, so it's easier for fires to start and spread. The exception is if there's an increase in precipitation, and for every degree of warming, you need about a 10% increase in precipitation to keep the fuel moisture approximately the same. So, and most of the models do not suggest that kind of increase in precipitation, so the fuels are drier. Second, temperature has a strong positive correlation with lightning. So the warmer it is, the more lightning we have, and the more fire starts. Though I need to do some more literature search to see how strong that correlation is. Third, the warmer it is, the longer the fire season. And this is particularly important at northern latitudes. The graph shows 2011 annual surface temperature across the globe. 2011 was the ninth warmest year, even though there was a La Nina for most of the year. And 9 of the 10 warmest years on record have been this century. 1998 was the exception, and that was a strong El Nino year. There's a number of papers that talk about temperature and fire, and I cite the paper by Parisian et al. In Ecological Applications, published last year. Now, this is work that's been done in Canada, and this just showed projections of area burned. And once again, the key variable was temperature and fuel moisture, and it showed about a doubling of area burned in Canada for a three times CO2 scenarios, or equivalents, by the Canadian and Hadley model. In the eastern Canada, they're very similar. In the western Canada, there are some divergences. It's because the Canadian model is a little cooler and wetter than that Hadley run. So this is work by Mike Balshi and others, and he used a MARS approach and using A2, B2, or for western Canada, Alaska, and depending on which scenario and what time, mid-century, late century, we're looking at 2.5 to 5.5 times increase in area burned. So that's significantly more than the earlier one, which was a doubling. So there was a literature review done a few years ago looking at global fire and climate change. And the majority of the studies suggest area burned increases, though there was very few global studies at that time. Fire and currents increases, fire season increases. The message was more mixed with respect to fire intensity and fire severity. And one example of the fire occurrence was published by Mike Watton and others looking at changes in fire occurrence in Canada caused by lightning and human caused. And it's done by ecoregion, provincial ecoregion, and that's human caused 2090, and that's lightning caused. And we see some areas of no change, but we do see significant areas of increases. They did not change the lightning frequency. The increases in lightning caused fires is due to drier fuels. So this gets me to the point where the most recent work I've done, it was just completed last Monday, and we're using the Canadian Forest Fire Danger Rating System, which is used across Canada and many parts of the world. Many of the global products use the Canadian system. We use something called a cumulative DSR to determine the severity of the fire season. The DSR is a function of the Fire Weather Index, which is a measure of the intensity of the fire, and it provides a measure of how difficult it is to suppress a fire. So what I'm driving at here is, if fire increases in the future like we expect, how much will this affect fire management capabilities? And I also looked at changes in fire season length. So for the baseline observed data, used NSEP reanalysis data to determine the Canadian FWI system, including the DSR for 71 to 2000. Three emission scenarios, the standard IPCC 3 A1B, A2B1 for three GCMs, Canadian, Hadley, and French. We superimposed anomalies from the future decade over the baseline and calculated a ratio. And we also calculated change in fire season length. On the picture here, this is a MOAS picture showing fires in Quebec driving smoke down into the eastern seaboard, New York, Washington. In Canada, we export hockey players, cold fronts, and now we export smoke.
You are listening to a presentation by Dr. Mike Flanagan, one of Canada's top fire experts. This is Radio EcoShock with a recording from the 2012 meeting of the AAAS.
And you can see most of the globe, especially in the north, this is mid-century, is a significant increase. Now, many of these increases, we're showing a doubling to tripling of DSR, which is a very significant increase. So if I go ahead to layer century, this is still a B1 scenario, and I'll toggle back and forth so you can see that it is getting worse as the century progresses, and much more agreement in North America as we move along. The Canadian was the coolest model and the wettest model. The other two models, the French and the Hadley, were in much closer agreement than the Canadian model. It's interesting that Africa isn't doing a great deal in the B1 scenario. So let's move to A1B. This is mid-century. Same sort of legend. If all three agree increases, it's the red. But what you do note is that there's very little areas of decrease. There are some areas of no change, but mostly it's increases. It's mostly the northern hemisphere, though you do see increases in Australia and parts of South America. So that's mid-century. End of the century, same sort of pattern as the B1 scenario, is that end of century is much worse. You can see Europe spreads to the Iberian Peninsula and more of South America. And let's move on to the A2 scenario, mid-century, same legend, end of century, mid-century, end of century, mid-century. And it's all three scenarios have very similar agreement that cumulative DSR is going to increase significantly. So I had a manager, and he always would say when I published something or when I had new exciting results, he'd say, so what? Okay. So here's the so what. Okay. And just for your information, this is a Landsat picture of Slave Lake, and that's part of the community. And you can see the two fingers of the fire, and this is the one that burnt into town. Modern fire management is challenging today. We just have to look. Canada, United States, and Australia are probably the leaders in the world, and we've been struggling. In California, in Texas, last year, over $5 billion, number of people died. We had problems in Alberta last year. Australia had serious issues, 2009. There's been problems in Russia, 2010, problems in the Mediterranean. And some of these are occurring in areas where we have the best fire management organizations in the world. But you can't put out all the fires all the time. They're very efficient, 95 to 99% of the fires they do put out. But the ones that do get away cause all the damage. And it's so in the future, if the intensity of the fires increase, it means you cannot attack the front of the fire because it's not safe for humans to be in front of it. Also, if it gets too intense, aircraft is not effective. So what I'm saying is if these fires become more intense, fire management will be less effective, even for modern fire management agencies. And less sophisticated fire management agencies will be completely overwhelmed. I also looked at fire season length. It was a simple temperature-based index, and you can see the kind of the modeled area in much of the equatorial tropical zones means that it's basically all your fire season in terms of temperature already. So the biggest increases are the northern hemisphere, and it's the same sort of pattern as I showed before. Three scenarios. This is the B1 for the three models. If they all agree, it's red. So the same sort of legend, and you can see the northern hemisphere fire season should increase. Most of the increases were around 20 days. So it's a significant lengthening of fire season. That's mid-century, end of century, not much change. So most of the fire season changes will have happened by mid-century. This is A1B, same sort of pattern. And here's A2, same sort of pattern, very consistent. we're going to have longer fire seasons, which isn't much of a surprise. Now, I'd like to shift gears and just talk about carbon for a couple of minutes, if I may. Fire in Canada plays a major role to determine whether our ecosystem or our forest is a source or a sink. In recent years, our forests have been a source of carbon due to things like mountain pine beetle and fire activity. And there's kind of three ways fire and carbon interact. First is through combustion. Flaming and smoldering combustion, greenhouse gases, including carbon, are released to the atmosphere. Decomposition. After fire goes through, there's a lot of dead organic material. This decomposes and releases carbon. And the third aspect is that many of the fires occur, at least in the forest, in semi-mature to mature stands. And these are stand-renewing fires, so there's a new crop of vegetation which has a completely different carbon dynamics. It's a much better sink as it grows up. Generally, after a fire, it's a carbon source for anywhere from 2 to 15 years, and after that, it becomes a carbon sink again. So I do want to talk about peat. There's about 700 petagrams of carbon stored in the circumboreal forest. This is Siberia and Canada, Alaska, and it's about a third of the terrestrial carbon. And much of this is legacy carbon. It's been accumulating over thousands of years. Now, climate change will mean the thawing of permafrost, and there'll be more droughts, and peat fires will become more common. And peat fires can release significant amounts of greenhouse gases. Published work from Indonesia suggested that fires in 1997 released 20 to 40% of global fossil fuel emissions, or the equivalent. Our peat reserves in the circumboreal dwarf anything in Indonesia, and peat fires can be hard to put out. They can burn right through winter and then start up again next spring. So it's a very serious issue that this could be a positive feedback. So the positive feedback is fossil fuels lead to warmer temperatures, more fire, and more fire leads to more greenhouse gases. Now, some people may argue that there's been warmer periods in the past and, you know, this has happened before. And to a degree, that is true. But the past is not an analog because the rapidity of the warming may make these peatland reserves extremely vulnerable, unlike the past. Options, adaptations, we have updated enhanced fire danger rating systems, and we're working on that in Canada already. Global early warning systems, we're also working on that already. Regional cooperations, we have to learn to share resources. We already are doing this in the developed countries, but we have to do it in the developing countries. Training and education, FireWise, FireSmart program, and we have to enforce policies rather than just giving them lip service. So, in summary, fire and weather are strongly linked. A warmer world will have more fire. Changes in wildland fires may be the greatest early impact of climate change on forests and wildlands. Traditional approaches to fire management may no longer be viable, and there's a potential for significant positive feedback through peat fires and the need for international cooperation. Thank you.
That was Mike Flanagan speaking on wildfires and climate change at the special session of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in February 2012. You can download my Radio EcoShock interview with Mike Flanagan in the May 2011 program titled Flood, Fire, and Wind, Climate Shift. That's at ecoshock.org. It's a 13-minute interview. About 2 weeks after this broadcast, you can also download a free MP3 of Mike Flanagan's full speech at the AAAS from our Climate 2012 page. All of today's speakers will be there in full, plus this program. Can we say there are more fires now than at any time in human history? What about fires in the past hot ages in the previous greenhouse worlds? I listened to two presentations on the history of fire by Douglas Wolford from Canada's Wolford Laurier University and Richard Routledge, Simon Fraser University. The science was too complicated for radio broadcast. I came away thinking in the field of fire archaeology, if you want to call it that, it's still very young. Do we know enough to answer those questions, to compare our future to the distant past of fire? It sounds like much more research is needed.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to the best of Radio EcoShock, a special on forest fires and climate change, recorded at the 2012 annual meeting of the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, by myself, Alex Smith. Fire smoke travels huge distances, sometimes smudging out part of a continent. In the soot below, human lungs don't do very well. As we'll hear from our third speaker, hundreds of thousands of humans die every year from inhaling smoke from natural and agricultural fires. But first, you should hear this Canadian medical expert, Dr. Mike Brower. He explains big advances in predicting the smoke plumes so people with breathing difficulties can be warned and do something about it. It's almost like tornado warnings, only more accurate. Pharmacies can know when to stock up on inhalers, and Brower ends up with tips you can use to protect yourself if smoke fills up your air. Following the introduction by session organizer Charmaine Dean of Simon Fraser University, here is Mike Brower addressing a special session of the American Academy in February 2012.
I'm going to talk about health impacts of fire smoke. Most people thinking about fires and health actually think about property damage, direct influences of the fires themselves. But there is now quite a bit of evidence of impacts of smoke. And really, when we actually think about air pollution episodes in developed countries, we have done a pretty good job of dealing with extremes in air pollution in urban areas due to industrial emissions, traffic-related emissions. We still have sort of chronic exposure to pollutants from those sources. But really, one of the major, if not the major source of episodes of air pollution in developed countries are fire smoke. So in a location that's impacted by a fire smoke, that's almost certainly going to be the highest concentration so that population will experience that year. So just a little bit of background to put this in perspective. What do we know about air pollution and health? And specifically, I'm going to focus mostly on airborne particulate matter. This is the heart of the air pollution that we have the strongest associations with population health impacts. From studies that have been done now in over 400 cities in the world, we know that on days with the worst air pollution, more people die. So daily changes lead to more deaths. It's important to consider air pollution for any one individual. The individual risk is very small. But what makes it important from a public health perspective is that everybody is exposed. So the population impact can be very large. So everybody always asks me, you know, can you see a patient, you know, can you see air pollution disease? No, we can't. It's a contributing risk factor. But when we do these statistical associations, we can actually estimate the population impact. And you can contrast that with something like smoking, where we know the risk to an individual is very large. But fortunately, in a country like Canada, actually the population exposure to smoke, the proportion of the population that smokes is rather low and decreasing. That's a good thing. We also know that in more polluted areas, people die earlier than in less polluted areas. And the evidence base for that is somewhat smaller. We don't have 400 studies, but we have in the hundreds and 100 or so studies like that. This figure here is just to illustrate if we're talking about something like death, which is very easy to understand, that's really sort of a tip of the iceberg phenomenon. The proportion of the population that may experience death as a result of air pollution, whether that's chronic exposure or an episode situation, is rather small. But underlying that are a whole other series of health impacts that actually affect a greater proportion of the population. And in some cases, these actually add up to sort of contribute to earlier death. So I'm actually going to be focusing on sort of two indicators that we've primarily used in our forest fire smoke work, and that will be a visit to a general practitioner and medication use. So these are things that sort of affect a somewhat larger proportion of the population, therefore easier to detect. And that's important when we talk about forest fires because often they don't actually impact large urban areas. So in order to get the statistical power to actually detect these sort of risks of air pollution exposure, we need large populations or sort of long time series of data in order to identify something like a death. Forest fires sometimes impact smaller communities, rural areas, and so we like some kind of an indicator that we're more likely to see a signal. So what do we actually know about fire smoke? This is just a quote from a review a number of us did several years ago, which was actually looking at sort of biomass smoke in general, whether it was burning in fires, burning from agricultural land clearing, from actually burning wood for heating or cooking. And when we sort of looked at all the evidence, basically we see sort of a number of respiratory outcomes, symptoms, hospital admissions, emergency room visits, respiratory disease, some clinical measures like decreased lung function, very consistent associations with increased levels of particulate matter in the air. And a number of studies suggest that asthmatics are a particularly susceptible subpopulation with respect to smoke exposure. Here's just one example of a study that we did focusing on the 2003 fires. Don't really need to do any statistics to look at this. This is showing the difference in weekly physician visits compared to a long-term mean and the difference in weekly levels of particulate matter in the air, again, compared to a long-term mean. And you can really see quite clearly, although there's some variability, when the levels of particulate matter increase, and this is all due to the fires, smoke from the fires, you saw this increase in weekly visits to physicians. And this is actually specific for asthma. If you look at actually some other outcome, we looked at mental illness type visits, anxiety type visits, you don't see any relationship there. This is the other indicator I mentioned to you. This is looking at filled prescriptions for inhalers, reliever medication. This is actually taking advantage of something that we have available in Canada as a result of the universal health coverage. We can actually track things like physician visits. So in order for a physician to be paid, they have to submit a claim to the system. We can actually tag that to an individual. We can actually do the same thing for filled prescriptions. So we can develop these data. And this is just aggregated to a local health area, which is just a spatial unit. And this is a time series of data of about 6 years. What you can see here, these are summer periods, and these are sort of periods that we nominally estimate a sort of fire season in this region. And actually, in most years, there's a drop in the prescriptions filled for reliever medication. That may have to do with just people moving around and doing things. That may have to do with infectious diseases. I haven't really thought about that, actually, too much detail. But what you can see is actually there are some events during the summer when you get real extremes in these reliever medication prescriptions. There are also extremes outside of the fire season. But pretty much every time that you see actually an extreme during that summer period, it was a day when you had a high level of particulate matter in the air. And again, in these regions, we know quite well that when particulate matter gets, the mean levels are somewhere around 10 or even lower micrograms per cubic meter. When it gets above 25, certainly, so any of these blue lines, this is fire. So really, we're starting to see a signal here that we can actually think about using even for surveillance. And the important thing in this is that this is something that is so sensitive that we can actually pick up signals in very small communities, communities of sort of 10,000 people, for example, where we'd never be able to see an increase in the deaths because just the population sizes are so small. Both of those results I just showed you were based on having ground-based air monitoring, which is what we primarily use to assess impacts of air quality in urban areas. But what we know about forest fires is that often they impact rural areas and smaller communities where there's no monitoring available. So in order to have a complete picture of the system, we need to actually think about ways to go beyond air monitoring. And this is relevant for Canada. It's relevant for British Columbia, which is a place that actually has very dense monitoring. We have some communities in British Columbia, populations less than 5,000 people, where there's a regular air monitoring, which is actually unprecedented in the world. There are many cities in the world, the populations of 1 million people, where there's no air monitoring. So we actually want to think about tools that are useful for us here, but also are applicable elsewhere in the world. In fact, the majority of the world where there is no air monitoring. Another thing that's important about looking beyond ground-based air monitoring data is that monitors actually may not function during extreme episodes. So we have several examples, and I'll show you a few, but certainly in the fires that affect Southern California, where, again, a very dense monitoring system, but the monitors all fail during fire events. So they become overloaded, break down, and even in very extreme fires, you may lose power, for example, so the monitors don't function. It's sort of the worst scenario that your system that you're using to tell you about air quality and smoke may not function when you actually need it the most. So in order to mount a public health response, we'd like at least real-time information. Ideally, we even like forecasting these events. So we've been using actually for a number of years some remote sensing approaches and sort of seeing how well they can actually predict health responses. So one system that we've used quite a lot, this is something that is actually operational that NOAA puts out, called the Hazard Mapping System. And these are actually technician-drawn smoke plumes from seven different remote sensing platforms. So they actually put these sort of two together and twice a day come up with sort of composite smoke plume images for North America. So it's semi-quantitative, but it's something that's relatively real-time and is available. Some of the disadvantages are that this is really detecting smoke in the total column. So it's not giving us something at the ground. And depending on the vertical stratification of the aerosol in the atmosphere, that may or may not represent well what you're experiencing on the ground. Also, we don't get any signal during cloudy days, and it's only available during daytime. So those are some of the limitations when we think about applying it. And just to focus a little bit more closely on the area where we're actually seeing all the action, so in these age groups between sort of 20 and 50 years old, really all I want you to take from this is that we're seeing, you know, in general, there's certainly differences in the magnitude of the effect estimated by each of these different approaches. There's also differences in the uncertainty. So you can see, for example, those images, just the remote sensing images of smoke plumes are very uncertain because they're semi-quantitative. But in general, the pattern is similar. All of these are showing elevated risks in relation to those physician visits. So we thought about that, and we thought, well, maybe now when we have some smoke forecasting tools, which we do now have, actually, did those predict health response? And that's what these smoke forecasting tools should be doing if they're going to be useful. So fortunately, over the last several years, a large group has sort of brought more or less a U.S. system into Canada and adapted it to a Canadian data sources. This is called Blue Sky, the Blue Sky smoke forecasting system. We now have forecasts that are developed up to 60 hours in advance of where smoke will travel throughout Western Canada, and includes sort of northwestern, all the way to northwestern Ontario, the Yukon, Northwest Territories, Nunavut, and the U.S. border states. It's on roughly a 10 by 10 kilometer grid cell. So that's the spatial resolution of the predictions. And they're predicted, we get hourly predictions up to 60 hours in advance for ground level concentrations. So the model performance actually hasn't been evaluated very thoroughly. There's sort of been one evaluation in the U.S. So, and this is actually Angela's work, who's here today. We thought we should evaluate the model performance based on monitoring data and a few other parameters, and then see if we can actually evaluate it based on health response. So what we did is sort of use a forecasting tool, but looking back now a couple years where we can actually collect the health data, see how well it works.
If you've just tuned in, this is Dr. Michael Brower, a Canadian-based expert on the impacts of fire smoke, recorded by Radio EcoShock.
So now I'm going to move to sort of what about health impacts? How well does this forecasting tool predict health impacts? This is showing 2010, which was a really extreme fire season in British Columbia. These are just the fire counts by size. And I'm going to show you data from one local health area called Local Health Area 27. Why did I pick that? Well, this region is right about here. And it's a region that was closest to sort of where the majority of the fires were. The population of this health region is about 25,000 people. About 10,000 of them live in this community of Williams Lake, which is by far the largest community in the health region. And this is where it is within British Columbia. And we're sort of right down at the bottom left corner today. So this is looking at reliever medication prescription counts. So these are, again, counts of filled prescriptions, inhalers for asthmatics or individuals with chronic lung disease. And I'm showing you both the monitoring data. So this is a community so these are the monitors in Williams Lake. Although these counts fill up that whole health region, these are the Blue Sky predictions. You can see actually a few cases where there's no monitoring data. So guess what? That's when I mentioned that issue where the monitors malfunction. Here's another example where there was a monitored value, but we can tell from some parameters in the monitoring data that it was probably overloaded.
So that's probably an underestimate of the true concentration. These are the blue sky predictions in blue, and then you can see the reliever medication counts as well. So when we see, and this is a long-term mean in the prescription counts, so the baseline, so you can see some fluctuation. These are Sundays, actually, when pharmacies tend to be closed. So quite sort of sensitive, and there's probably a bit of a Monday spike after Sunday in many situations. But when we get these big spikes, they coincide with both the monitored values as well as the predicted values. So this is exactly what we'd like to see, that these predictions are actually predicting health events. So there's that situation where that monitor is probably overloaded. And then looking at respiratory outpatient visits, so these are visits to physicians for respiratory disease. It's a little bit noisier here. You can see, again, sort of a weekend effect here. So this is not going to emergency room. This is just going to primarily general practitioners, many of which are closed on weekends. And again, you probably see sort of a Monday bump afterwards. But when we get these sort of extreme peaks, certainly these two, they do coincide, fire smoke events as well, and in fact with the predictions from the forecasting system. So if we have a forecasting system that actually seems to predict health impacts, the next thing we'd like to do is actually give some public health guidance. And there's actually a very good document that I helped work on a number of years ago, and I would say it's really still current, that was put out by the states of California and Washington. So if any of you are interested in sort of public health response, there's the link for that. Some of the things that are recommended are room air cleaners. And I just want to show you some data from a study. Another one of my students did a number of years ago, work Prabhjit Barn did, where we actually chased fires. And when we got to a community that was impacted by fire smoke, she found volunteers and she put air cleaners in their homes and measured the levels of particulate matter inside their homes, which is actually where people spend most of their time. So these are concentrations without the air cleaner, and these are concentrations with the air cleaner, both sort of 24-hour measurements. And this is now adjusted for, so this is how much smoke actually infiltrates. So it's adjusted for whatever the outdoor concentration is. You can see that, and these are, again, all homes impacted by fire smoke. So depending on the home, and there's a little bit of air here, but up to sort of 100% of the smoke can infiltrate, down to 20-25%, depending on whether they open windows or not, whether they have air conditioning, how tightly the home is sealed just due to its construction. So there's a lot of variability in homes. But in essentially all cases, when you operated this air cleaner, you dropped the level of particulate matter indoors. And on average, there is a 65% decrease in indoor fire smoke when you operated one of these air cleaners. And I'll point out, these are relatively inexpensive, $100 to $200. They're really not, they basically have a pleated paper filter inside and a fan that's pumped. So as long as they're sized appropriately for the room, essentially it's drawing in dirty air and cleaning out the particulate matter. Really very effective in terms of reducing the smoke levels. We weren't able to measure health impacts in this study because we never knew where the fires were going to be. But in a subsequent study in wood-burning communities, so it's a little bit different type of pollution, it's a more predictable exposure. We did exactly the same kind of study, randomized, actually blinded to the participants, and we saw, again, these decreases in indoor concentrations of particulate matter, and also saw improvements in a number of measures of health, so improvements in inflammatory responses, measures of blood vessel function. So it really looks like these filters improve air quality, and you get a health benefit for that. So that's exactly what we'd like to see and what we'd like to recommend to people. Some other things that are recommended are, well, air conditioning does a similar thing. We'd like to see communities, and this has been done in some parts of British Columbia, establish clean air shelters. So communities that are likely to be impacted by forest fire smoke have sort of a smoke response plan. So just like we do in heat events, we have cool air shelters, we can have clean air shelters. And it really could be something, any type of structure where there's a heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system where you can put in some level of filtration. Could be a school, could be a shopping mall. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. Outdoor workers, people who have to be outdoors, are probably the only population that we'd recommend wearing a respirator. When I first started working on fire smoke, it was in Southeast Asia, in this episode that you've heard about in 1997. And everybody was sort of grabbing these air filters. In fact, these respirators, in fact, they depleted the world's supply of them. But
We saw very clearly that they weren't providing any protection. So you saw babies wearing them, and the air, you know, air goes through the path of least resistance, which is right around this. I saw people sort of going outside of a building, putting it over like this, and then taking it off when they got in their cars, you know, and there's just as much smoke inside their cars. So it really provides a false sense of security. It was probably doing more harm than good. Very importantly, you can see that link to medication use. We've seen some examples where pharmacies will actually deplete their supply if they're not prepared. So we'd like to actually see pharmacies be prepared in terms of having enough medication, individuals before fire season actually meeting with their healthcare practitioners to sort of set up a plan, making sure they have enough medication so we don't have to see a rush to the physician actually during an event, which is actually when we want people probably to be staying inside or staying in protected area, especially if you're imagining someone with chronic lung disease, even exerting themselves is really a challenge. And then in the more extreme situations, evacuation. And I think Mike mentioned earlier that evacuations are sort of often we evacuate people because of smoke. It's very expensive. We have communities where we actually fly in Hercules transports and fly out the whole community. Certainly, we'd like to know from forecasting whether we should do that or not. But ideally, we'd like to avoid that and only use that as a last resort. So really trying to combine all this information with the forecast, we can, I think, give better advice. So I will end there, and if there's time, take a question or two. Thank you.
That was Dr. Michael Brower at the AAAS meeting. Our final presenter in this week's special on fire and climate change is Dr. Faye Johnson, a physician and environmental epidemiologist at the Menzies Research Institute in Tasmania, the Down Under of Australia. Her topic for this session of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science is the estimated global mortality burden attributable to landscape fire smoke. Let's find out who really pays the ultimate price for advancing fires in a crowded, warming world. We only have time for a few excerpts. First, what is a landscape fire and who is studying it?
Thanks very much, Charmaine. What I'm going to do today is present a collaboration between Australia, Canada and the US, and a group of us combined to try and estimate what the global annual mortality was, deaths on average was, from landscape fire smoke globally. And our team consisted, we were in two groups. There were the health researchers, such as myself, with Mike Brower and Sarah Henderson, and a group of earth system scientists, fire ecologists, including Ruth De Vries, who's here at this meeting. And together we tried to make this first assessment. And when I use the term landscape fire smoke, I should explain what I mean by that. I mean all sorts of fires, including Australian bushfires, forest fires, but including prescribed burns, agricultural burning, peat fires, tropical deforestation fires, boreal fires. It's a collective term for all sorts of biomass smoke that comes from burning landscapes. And the general structure of my talk is that I'll give a brief background with the aims. I'll spend a lot more time on the methods, of course, because that's always the hard bit about global modelling, and then describe our results with some of our sensitivity analyses. So for background, this is an image that comes from a paper by Guido van der Werf describing the Global Fire Emissions Database, which is an international collaborative program. It shows the distribution of where fires burnt on the planet over a 10-year period, 2000 to 2009, and every colour there represents the main type of vegetation that was burning. So the orange, for example, forest fires in the boreal in the northern hemisphere, and also there's some in the southern parts of Australia. The pale green and pale blue are the savanna and woodland fires, and the yellow are agricultural burns. And you can see the regions where they dominate. The dark green that you see around the centre are a special sort of fire. They're tropical deforestation fires. So they're purposely lit to clear tropical rainforest, usually to repurpose for soybeans or palm oil or other sources. The thing about this figure is it shows you what types of vegetation support fire or what places on earth support fire. So there's big gaps where there's deserts, where there's no vegetation, where there's ice. But also you can see tropical rainforests are white as well, or under normal circumstances they would be white. That's not a vegetation type that would normally support fire. And this is an image from NASA showing Southeast Asia on a particular day when the weather conditions suddenly favoured clearing rainforest and favoured agricultural burning. And the red dots are hot spots. They're anomalies that show that a fire is burning in that area. And you can see the large smoke haze associated with it. And that's over a very densely populated region of the world. And Mike's explained to you some of the health effects of that. It was understanding the scale of these fires, particularly in tropical regions, that motivated me to try and get this project together. Fire smoke is made up of both gases and aerosols. As most of you would be aware, the main gas is CO2, but there's hundreds of others as well. The aerosols include black and organic carbon, and that's measured as particulate matter. Again, there's others as well, but they're the dominant ones, and particulate matter less than 2.5 microns in diameter is the one that's of particular interest for the health effects. And others in this room would know about the impacts on radiative forcing, the global carbon balance, hydrological cycles, the aerosols affect cloud formation, which affects regional rain distribution. And what I will be focusing on is human health. So our aim was to estimate... Oh, this other image is another NASA image from South America showing a huge river of smoke across the entire continent to the east of the Andes. Our aim in doing this was to come up with a number, and which we did. It was a bit over 300,000, but there's a lot of uncertainty. There's assumptions you have to make at every step of the way. So although we've come up with a number, the idea was really to see, is this an important public health issue in the context of other public health issues that the planet faces, but also to be very clear to describe the assumptions we made for it, to assess their uncertainty and to assess how sensitive our final estimate was to these various assumptions.
We are listening to Dr. Faye Johnson from the University of Tasmania as she describes the first attempts to quantify the impacts of global wildfires. As she says, a world without fire does not exist.
The other really hard thing is, because fire is so integral to the planet, a world without fire doesn't exist. Most vegetation systems support it. How do we work out what's background, what is potentially modifiable? So there's this term, the theoretical minimum exposure, sometimes called the counterfactual. And it's really trying to understand what is background, what can we expect to change. And, of course, there's no data on that. That's something we estimated in a number of different ways. The other thing you need to know is what the health effects are, the concentration response coefficients. How much of a rise in mortality can you expect to see with a given rise in air pollution? And also you need to know the temporal scale of that as well as the spatial scale. For example, a daily rise in particulate matter causes a roughly 1% increase in mortality, but a yearly average rise of the same amount has a much larger influence on mortality.
In our final clip from Faye Johnson, we find the science of fire and smoke is still mostly based in the developed world.
For months on end, year after year, they're spatially scattered in time, they're scattered, and the exposure might last anything from one day, a week, possibly 2 weeks, but it's unusual for it to go on for months on end, similar in southern parts of Australia. But around the centre, particularly where rainforest and savanna fires dominate, where there's seasonal burning and wet, dry, monsoonal weather patterns, the pattern of exposure there tended to be extensive for months on end for most years, more than 3 months. And that had a major influence on the way we ended up doing our estimations. Okay, so I'll move now to how we did it. As a general approach, we decided we'd follow the World Health Organization, who many of you might be aware already have, or for at least 20 years now, had a program going to estimate annual burden of disease from a whole lot of specific diseases such as malaria, but also specific environmental risk factors. And they've already published estimates for urban air pollution, for indoor pollution from cook stoves, from unsafe water, from increased body mass index, a whole range of risk factors. So there's a framework there, and there's also a geographical, there's sub-regions of the world, there are 21 of them, so we mapped our estimates to those same 21 sub-regions, and we took the same data sets for mortality that we used for those and map those to the same spatial resolution. We also made the decision that wherever we could, we would use specific evidence for mortality impacts of landscape fire smoke rather than evidence from other sources of air pollution. And there's a huge literature out there on the health effects of particulate matter in urban contexts, but the vast majority of it comes from North American big cities, European cities, a few from cities in Asia, but there's... By comparison, the evidence base for landscape fire smoke is quite tiny. But whatever evidence there is, there are studies of mortality, and those studies have been done in places like Southeast Asia, where the populations are quite different, the exposures are quite different, the background exposure to urban and cook stove pollution is quite different. So we thought that it would be more sensible to take those studies and apply those in our modelling rather than European studies, urban air pollution studies rather. That also meant that we weren't able to use cause-specific mortality. The more recent estimates for the World Health Organization studies look at heart mortality, lung mortality, infant mortality separately. Because of the limited evidence based on fires, we didn't do that. And we decided to analyse the sporadically exposed regions and the chronically exposed regions differently, which basically meant that we used a daily exposure and daily fluctuations for sporadically affected areas, but we used yearly average for the chronically affected areas. So this was the first step, was to then try and classify the 21 World Health Organization subregions as sporadic or chronic. And we did this in a data-driven way. We just looked at the number of cells, exposure cells, and each exposure cell, if it was above the 90th centile of the distribution, was defined as being smoke-affected. And if most of the area of the region or most of the population of the region were in a smoke-affected cell, we defined that whole region as chronically affected, which meant that there was fire smoke affecting that population for at least 3 or 4 months of most years. And other regions, if they didn't meet that definition, we called sporadic. Okay, so taking the sporadically exposed, or the places we analysed as sporadically exposed, which are the paler ones on the figure there, we took daily average exposures and applied an average increase in mortality by day. We constrained that by taking a minimum of 5 and a maximum of 200, which meant that if the exposure estimate was less than 5, we discounted it. If it was above 200, we set it to 200, really to allow for uncertainties in the exposure estimate and to allow for enough of an increase to have a meaningful impact. We took, as I said, the coefficients from landscape fire studies, the largest of which was done in Southeast Asia. We used all-cause mortality and modelled that with a linear response, which is what the evidence was from these papers. As it turned out, the coefficient was very similar to the all-cause mortality from big urban studies of PM2.5, with roughly a 1% increase in deaths for a rise in 10 micrograms of PM2.5. And in chronically exposed areas, it's a similar sort of procedure. We used yearly average exposures. We constrained that to a maximum of 50, an annual average of 50, which was about the highest anyway. There weren't that many ones over that level. For this exposure, we really needed to include a counterfactual estimate because of the chronic nature of the exposure. And there were different ways of doing this, but what we ended up doing was taking the minimum of the yearly rolling average of every cell in a region and then getting the regional mean for that. So the counterfactual was applied by region rather than by cell. And the reason for that really is that there's huge variation, as most of you would know, in how fire burns and how landscapes are managed. And on satellite images, you can see very similar biomes and vegetations, and you can pick the country border because of different practices on either side of the border. So we chose to go with the regional mean. And there are no studies of landscape fire smoke that we could find that actually looked at year-long average exposures. There's one from Southeast Asia that looked at infant mortality over a three-month period, and that, but none for annual average. So we stuck with all-cause mortality, and we used a fairly conservative estimate available from the literature for urban air pollution. Okay, so these are the results you can see mapped there across the globe. The darkest two squares, the very dark square, is an average of 10,000 deaths per annum in that spatial unit. The next one down is between 5 and 10,000 deaths. The paler two are less than 500 deaths per annum. So you can see straight away that the big impact on this study was in sub-Saharan Africa and in Southeast Asia. South America had huge emissions, but the population is more sparse there, and that's the reason that one hasn't quite lit up in the same way that the exposure estimates did. So specifically for the regions, South America, the annual estimate was 10,000, which is high enough, considering that a lot of that smoke is probably preventable, that which is sourced from the rainforest deforestation fires. Sub-Saharan Africa had the biggest estimate. Nearly half of our global estimate was from Africa, with 157,000 per annum. And in Southeast Asia, the estimate was 110. And that added up to about 340,000 globally.
That was Faye Johnson from the University of Tasmania talking about recent research into the global impacts of fire smoke on health. We've been listening to presentations I recorded in February 2012 at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver, Canada. Next week on Radio EcoShock, I've selected three key interviews with scientists and experts on the new superfires burning hotter than ever thanks to climate change. The forests we used to think captured and stored our carbon emissions are now returning that carbon at greater rates, adding to global warming. Remember, you can find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. The program blog with lots of links is published each Wednesday at ecoshock.info. And please use social media to tell your friends about Radio EcoShock on SoundCloud for easy audio browsing. Still at the news desk, as the troubled future unfolds, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week. Our music in this program is from the 1968 hit Fire by Arthur Brown.
Back. It is the Taylor Report, and it's CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're on Facebook / the Taylor Report and SoundCloud Taylor-Report. And I believe we have on the line Mr. Sid Ryan. Are you there, Sid?
I am indeed. Good afternoon. How are you?
Very well. And you were the former, you've been the president of the Ontario Federation of Labour and many years in the labour movement. Matter of fact, you are have written a book. We want to make sure we say that. And when is that book going to be out?
It's going to be out on April 27th, 2019, just in time for May Day.
Excellent timing.
Yes, that's what I thought,
though. So, Sid, you've been so many years in the labor movement, and you've been trying to, together with others, you struggle to make it an authentic labor movement that engages in socialist politics and such. And you're still in that battle, of course. There's a big one going on right now, and we want your thoughts about it. The lockout of IATSE, workers at the CNE. What's your first? What do you think of the situation and how we got into this?
Obviously, any lockout is always a concern, but. You know, this particular lockout, it sounds like they're trying to break the union by essentially contracting out all of their work. And that's a real problem, particularly when they're bringing scabs from out of province across the line. I mean, that clearly tells you this is a serious effort to break this union. So, I'm certainly hoping that – well, first off, two things. The labor movement – will not be crossing their picket lines come Labor Day, which is a huge windfall for the CNE on that particular day. My understanding now is that I just found out this afternoon that instead of marching to the CNE, the Labor Day parade will instead be marching to the Lamport Stadium, which I think is a really, really good decision because, you know, lots of people join in the Labor Day parade because they get in free to the CNE.
Yes.
So lots of those folks might still just go through the picket lines, and it would look like that Labor was crossing IATSE's picket lines, and I think that would be a disaster. So it's a good decision to take it to Lamport Stadium and not run the risk of having a bit of a mistake being made by some people.
Yeah. Now, by the way, if they're not going to – at some point, labor itself, in its thousands, is going to have to go to Queen's Park, aren't they, and do something about this situation of using, let us say, what is it, replacement workers / scabs.
Yeah.
We had legislation in this province, and Quebec still does. Can you talk about how important this is?
Bob Rae brought in the anti-scab legislation when he was in government in the 90 to 95 government, but Harris came in, and then within a couple of weeks of taking office, he had basically written that law off the books. So so we don't have anti-scab legislation right now, but it is so crucial. It would actually, there wouldn't be a lockout at this moment in time, you know, if we had anti-scab legislation. So I agree 1,000%. I don't understand why they're even marching up to Lamport Stadium. Like, why don't they politicize the Labor Day parade and turn it around and take it down to Queen's Park and have 30,000, 40,000 people on the lawns of Queen's Park protesting the policies of this Conservative government? Mm-hmm. That, to me, is what they really should be doing, and there's a golden opportunity. I don't even know why we continue today to be marching up to the CNE. Mm-hmm. Really and truly, the Labor Day parades mm-hmm. should be a bit more political, and we should be talking about the issues of the day. And you don't really do that by heading into the CNE, I don't believe.
Yes.
And there's no opportunity with the current parade. There's no opportunity to have any political speeches either at the beginning or at the end.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a bit of a farce of the Labor Day parade, in my opinion.
Yeah. This is Sid Ryan, former president of the Ontario Federation of Labor. The steelworkers in Quebec, they've been raising an issue. And I think, well, I guess it is a matter of legislation. I don't know if we had it here, but minimum wages and also protection of pensions, protection against the two-tiered wage system. Your thoughts about that?
Well, okay, so in this province, we just won the whole question about raising the minimum wage up to $14 an hour. But Ford is bringing in a piece of legislation, I understand, in September that's going to prevent that from going to $15 an hour. But I also understand that there may be, once you open up that section of the labor code, there's a possibility that he may go after right-to-work legislation he may very well be bringing in. We don't know at this stage. But in Quebec, in 2001, they actually passed legislation that made it illegal to negotiate two-tier wage systems. Like the Unifor did here in Ontario, where the new hires into the auto plants are going to be earning $17 an hour, working beside people earning $30 an hour doing exactly the same job. He made that illegal in Quebec in 2001. And then just recently, they made it illegal to negotiate two-tier pension plans. That was a piece of legislation that came in just, I think it was last October. And the steelworkers were fighting for that on the picket lines. He had many big, long strikes, even had big strikes here in Ontario. But sadly, it is possible to negotiate two-tier pension plans. And indeed, Unifor went and did the same thing in the auto sector for new hires coming in. So basically, what it ends up doing is screwing younger workers. It means that they don't have a defined benefit pension plan. What they do have is a defined contribution, which is essentially a glorified savings plan. And then, of course, he has a two-tier wage system. So that's not good for younger workers or the next generation of workers facing that kind of a system. And the problem with it is it spreads to other workplaces and other sectors.
It's like a virus, isn't it? I mean, once it happens, the precedent becomes a weight against the other people.
Of course it is. I mean, and when a big union like Unifor says, we can't defend defined contribution benefit plans anymore. But then, you know, it says the smaller unions, then you're wasting your time, you know, trying to fight against this. For example, the entire public sector has defined benefit pension plans. So all of our universities, all of our schools, all of our hospitals, all, you know, we have everybody in the public sector basically has got a defined benefit pension plan. It's now undermining the fight to keep those pension plans as defined benefit, because employers will be looking to the private sector and saying, huge segments of the private sector have given it up. Now it's time for you guys to give it up. And don't be in the least bit surprised if you start to see Doug Ford taking a look at the legislation around the defined benefit pension plan in the public sector and trying to do something along the lines of what the private sector have done.
Yeah. By the way, this underlines why I know you fought very hard against, as president of the OFL, against people who want to kind of depoliticize the efforts of unions, and you were, and there was a school of thought, and I noticed it kind of faded in the last election, but tried to say, well, we have to vote strategically, and so we'll pick out, which party or which candidate, totally confused their members.
Well, that's still very much alive, even though in the last election, you know, on the surface, we didn't hear a lot about it. But you still had the teacher unions like the OFSTF and OECTA, and you had most of the building trades underneath Pat Dillon, all still basically voting strategically right up until the bitter end. Mm-hmm. And even Unifor were still strategically voting until it became clear that Kathleen Wynne didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning. So then halfway through the campaign, I understand they pulled some of their workers quietly off the Liberal campaigns and they put them onto the NDP campaigns. But you know, in the next federal election, which is coming up in 2019, you're going to have all those same players pushing strategic voting just as much as they did in years gone by. So we haven't heard the end of strategic voting, not by a long shot.
Yeah, that's this whole business of how to address management and the leadership of the country. I thought it was a rather dark day when the president of Unifor had that warm embrace with the new prime minister as though he was going to look after labor for us. That really hasn't worked out, and particularly in the auto sector, as far as I can see.
No, it hasn't. But are you talking about the Buzz Hargrove's embrace, or are you talking about Jerry Dyson's
embrace? I'm sorry. There's more than one couple.
because they've done it. Both of them have done it. Uh-huh. And it has not. But, you know, in some respects, what it is, they're curry in favor with the Liberals, but then they go and they negotiate hundreds of millions of taxpayers' dollars to go into profitable corporations in the auto sector as an incentive to keep jobs here. So basically what they're doing is they toss the healthcare system and the education system underneath the bus, deprive them of much-needed resources, and those tax breaks then go into these very profitable corporations. Mm. I mean, it's a sad state of affairs when you start to put, pit one sector against another sector when it comes to dollars and that. I just don't understand that strategy, but I understand where they're coming from with their strategic voting. They obviously want to keep the Liberals elected because every time they go with a handout looking for tax breaks for the corporations. So they've got, the corporations have the union in lobbying government to give them tax breaks. Like it's pretty sick.
Yes. We're speaking to Sid Ryan. Now, there's a crisis that you have been focused on. And by the way, are you there? I think I might have lost you.
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Now we've had the formal this is something you've addressed, and I really hope people follow your writing on this subject, that is a Unifor decision to withdraw from the Canadian Labour Congress. This all began, I guess, in January of this year, and it's finally come to fruition in a formal way by Unifor about a week ago at their council leaving the CLC. Now, my understanding of your view is the CLC, OFL, and other labor bodies, their reaction should have been, you leave, you're gone. But they seem to have gone, but they're still around. Is there going to be a new chapter now that they've made it as official and clear and legal as possible?
Well, that was a sad day for labor when the leadership of Unifor convinced the rank and file leadership, if you will, to follow them down a blind alley when it comes to, raiding of other unions. And allegedly, Unifor is really concerned about the democracy within international unions. It's just a phony war, to be honest, where Dias has wrapped himself in the Canadian flag in order to be able to go out and to raid. And to get his members to go along with that and say at the same time, we're going to withdraw our funding from the CLC, which is exactly what happened to me when I was the president of the OFL. And it just destroys the ability of the labor movement to be able to fight back. I mean, I lost 25% of my funding almost overnight. And I don't know what the percentage is of UNIFAR's money coming out, but it's probably around the 15 to 20% of the CLC's total budget, which is a major hit, and which means then we can't mount the kind of campaigns that we ought to be doing. But the signal it sends is that if you disagree with leadership of the central labor bodies, the way to punish them is to just unilaterally pull your funding out of them. It is so undemocratic and it's so autocratic that it just destroys the solidarity within the movement. So now you've got UNIFOR officially outside. It wasn't just Jerry Dyce pulling them out. He's managed to convince his Canadian council to follow suit. Mm-hmm. So when it gets to, you know, whether it be fight backs collectively fighting back against Doug Ford or whatever the case may be, we're divided. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, UNIFOR is going to show up on Labor Day. You'll have a few speeches on Nate Phillips Square. And instead of them marching with the rest of Labor, they'll be taken off and going somewhere else.
They're
going
to go on a cruise. They're taking a cruise.
I hear they're supposed to be going on a boat cruise, which is just, you know, unbelievable.
That doesn't bode well for down the road, right? When we need unity, people will be tangled up. Do I go to that rally? Do I go to this march? These leaders can't meet each other because, in fact, it's defined as an antagonistic relationship.
Well, you know, like it was 2 years ago that Jerry Dyce called me out at a Labor Day parade of all times to basically say he wasn't going to be supporting me because he wanted to build unity within the labor movement, allegedly because there was four unions withdrawn their per capita, and they said that they wouldn't come back in unless I was gone. So he tossed his lot in with these scoundrels who withheld their money from the OFL. And here he is now, a year and a half, 2 years later, and what's he doing? He's doing exactly to the labor movement what he was complaining about, saying, oh, we need to put in Chris Buckley into the OFL so we can build unity. Well, I don't see an awful lot of unity right now within the labor movement, and you've got UNIFOR leading this parade to go after and denigrate all the international unions that make up 50% of the labor movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's and now you've got Buckley. He's not even he's not, his own union no longer belongs to the OFL. Same thing with Hassan Youssef. They both have fake memberships in other unions. It's a joke. It really is.
It's so important that people actually be representative when they say that they're representing a local or a union, that's true, rather than, here, I'll lend you my badge.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a joke of the process.
So what's going to happen, next year when the CLC has a convention to elect a new leader, and the same thing with the OFL? Are these people going to stand up and say, elect me, but I'm not from UNIFOR, I'm with the school teachers now, and the other guy says I'm with PSAC? It makes a mockery of the structure. It makes a mockery of the constitution of both the OFL and the CLC. And again, the membership, the leaders of the major unions in the country had an opportunity to stand up and say this is wrong, and they acquiesced. They basically ducked the question, and rather than taking on this whole notion of having a fake membership in another union.
Yeah. It is really a matter of what leadership is supposed to be about. And the conduct of labor leaders is supposed to be exemplary and not shady and not opportunistic, but to show the way. And that isn't that's not what we have. We're speaking to Sid Ryan in the moments that are remaining. I want to ask you again. You have a book, and it's called, I think it's The New Vision or The Vision.
No, it's called A Grander Vision.
So a Grander Vision.
It's basically, it's almost like the history of the labor movement from the past 30 years, written by a labor leader. I didn't have a ghostwriter. I wrote it myself. And also, I'm looking at...
You didn't have a replacement worker.
exactly. Workers need to be telling our own stories, and we need to be writing our own stories.
Yeah.
So I also look to the future. It isn't just about the past. That's why I call it a grander
vision. Speaking of the future, I think you and I are on the same wavelength because we started off here talking. Labor Day is coming up. It's always been an awkward experience to go to a parade early in the morning when nobody sees us, and you go to the gate and then they let you in free as though you were the hired help, and unorganized, by the way. And they say, oh, here's your little, I hate to use the word cheese, but it's your little reward. And a lot of labor people come from traditions that are a little more militant, and they don't really care to be taken to the Queen's Gate or Prince Gate or whatever it is. They'd like to do something that the whole city sees, and it is an expression of solidarity of labor. So how about we change it to the traditional International Day of Labor, which is May Day?
Hey, hallelujah. And that's where I've been at all my life. I don't understand why we, you know, this Labor Day in September was selected by the employers. It wasn't selected by labor ourselves, and then they give it and make it a holiday. And now we're unable to break away from it. But I just don't understand why Canada and United States are the only two countries in the world that celebrate Labor Day in September when the entire world are celebrating it on May the 1st. I just don't get it. Why we cannot be in line with the rest of workers around the world.
Yeah.
It is high time that we did it, and it's high time we politicized our Labor Day parade. I mean, we've even gotten to a point now where instead of having like a Labor Day parade, you've got picnics all over the place. But there's no real political message coming out of our Labor Day parade. And this, you know, this is the sad state of affairs. If we would just, you know, forget about September, whenever it is, because you're dead right. I mean, I've marched in it for the last 35 years, and we're walking along Queen Street, and it's basically devoid of people because everybody's off at the cottage or they're off whatever. And so we're walking, marching through empty streets up to the CNA, no political message, no speeches. It's disheartening, actually, is what it is.
Well, I think that tells us why we should look for your book, which will be out in time for May Day.
April 27, time for May Day.
I don't like to be subversive, but is it possible you could run for the president of the CLC?
I could, yeah.
Nothing's stopping me.
The only thing I will say that would be stopping me is there's an age restriction in that it's not written in law, it's not constitutional, but it's there. You retire at age 65, and I've just passed age 65, so no. But you know what? It would be,
have a Respect for Seniors May Day.
Maybe. You got it.
And make you the president. Sid, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Very
you
informative. Look forward to that book.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for promoting it as well.
Yep.
Okay, so all the best.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Max Blumenthal, who examines how fear of Russian fake news has provoked Facebook's censorship of legitimate websites, left and right. Elise Gerhardt, who recounts the arrest and imprisonment of her 63-year-old mother, Ellen Gerhardt, for interfering with the construction of the Mariner East 2 gas pipeline across her family's land in Pennsylvania. And Ed Mead, longtime prison reformer, former co-editor of Prison Focus, and one-time political prisoner, who discusses the nationwide strike to end prison slavery, launched on August 21st. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the first time, prosecutors in Saudi Arabia are seeking the death penalty against a woman activist, Isra Al-Ghamgham, solely related to her peaceful activism. She gained notoriety by filming Shia protests during the Arab Spring in 2011. Along with her husband, she was arrested and imprisoned in late 2015. Along with other human rights activists, Ghamgham was charged with protesting in Shia-dominated eastern Saudi Arabia. They were also charged with chanting slogans hostile to the Saudi kingdom and posting video of the protests on social media. The protests grew out of growing frustration with systematic discrimination aimed at Saudi Arabia's Shia citizens. A recent crackdown by the Saudi kingdom led to the arrest of 13 women activists under the pretext of maintaining national security. While some have since been released, others remained detained without charge. Among those arrested was Saudi American activist Samar Badawi, winner of the 2012 U.S. International Women of Courage Award for challenging the Saudi male guardianship system. Human rights monitors are openly critical of the Saudi kingdom for using the government's 2014 counterterrorism law to suppress dissent, targeting human rights defenders, bloggers, and journalists. Donald Trump's Treasury Department has moved to weaken financial disclosure requirements for secret dark money political groups, provoking an outcry from campaign finance reformers. Under the new rules, political nonprofits who spend money to influence elections are not required to share the names of donors with the Internal Revenue Service. In response, Montana's Democratic Senator John Tester introduced a bill to repeal the Treasury Department ruling. According to the American Prospect, the Treasury Department measure is in line with a well-orchestrated attack on disclosure by megadonors led by billionaire brothers Charles and David Koch. Now, groups including the Koch-funded Americans for Prosperity no longer are required to report millions of dollars in campaign spending. The Koch network has also been able to kill initiatives to require the disclosure of political donors. Dark money groups could claim their biggest victory with the confirmation of President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Supporters of campaign finance reform fear Kavanaugh would further scale back disclosure requirements. Americans for Prosperity and other conservative groups have already launched a multimillion-dollar ad campaign advocating the quick Senate confirmation of Kavanaugh. ProPublica reports health insurers are working hand-in-hand with big data companies to collect personal information on tens of millions of Americans. Data brokers are now able to track an individual's race, TV viewing habits, net worth, education, and social media posts. Health insurers can feed the data into a computer algorithm to project healthcare costs for specific individuals. If you're a woman who has purchased plus-size clothing, for example, insurers may consider you a risk for depression and expensive mental health treatment. But insurers insist they are only looking to spot potential health problems and not looking to justify higher insurance premiums. The synergy between the health insurance industry and big data comes amid a barrage of privacy scandals and corporate misuse of personal information. Consumers are protected from misuse of data by the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, but the measure only covers medical data, not personal information. Healthcare industry observers insist that U.S. policymakers could do more to protect personal information. California just passed a digital privacy law, giving consumers more control over their personal information online. Meanwhile, the European Union passed a strict law called the General Data Protection Regulation, which went into effect in May and imposes serious fines for violators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
When Facebook and other social media executives found themselves on the hot seat after charges that Russian hackers had posted phony news stories designed to influence the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election in favor of Donald Trump, they responded with what many observers believe was an over-the-top action plan. Facebook's response included outsourcing the job of policing their platform for phony news stories and foreign trolls to the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Labs, which has resulted in decisions to take down several legitimate websites falsely accused of being a product of Russian troll factories. Part of what we're told is a disinformation campaign with the goal of sowing chaos and discord in the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Max Blumenthal, editor of the GrayZoneProject.com, a fellow at the Nation Institute, and author of several books including The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Here he examines Facebook's recent takedowns of political websites on the right and the left, and the increasing threat of political censorship on social media platforms, linked to the foreign hacking of news websites.
Well, this is really a threat to dissent. And, you know, centrists who think that John Brennan, a former CIA director, is a hero, are not going to see their speech threatened. Those who are being threatened tend to be the alternative and dissident media that has really relied on Facebook to get lots of followers and likes and win over an alternative audience that's seeking something outside the corporate mainstream. And these sites, almost across the board, whether it's on the left or the right, are finding that their traffic is going down, that posts are being suppressed. I personally am forbidden from boosting my posts on Facebook, and we're just talking about factual journalism. I said from the outset, as soon as the Russiagate narrative was concocted by Clintonite dead-enders and the intelligence community, that it would pose the most long-term threat to the left and to left-wing progressives in the U.S., and that it was immediately directed at Donald Trump. But their media and their activism would be targeted, and we saw that first with the government Senate Intelligence Committee starting to pressure Facebook about this Russian troll farm, and there certainly was a troll farm. 56% of the posts of that troll farm on Facebook appeared after the election. Most were not designed to elect Donald Trump. Some were pro-Hillary. Some were pro-Trump. And I think that none had any effect on the way that anyone voted. It was basically a red herring to deepen the Russiagate narrative. And now we've seen Facebook being pressured to pair up with a group called the Digital Forensic Research Lab, which is an arm of the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council is one of the most militaristic think tanks in Washington. It's funded not only by NATO, the permanent war alliance in Europe, but by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and a who's who of arms manufacturers. And this digital forensics lab has been given the task of finding the evildoers on Facebook so that Facebook can ban them. And they have targeted people, sites that may be Russian troll farm operations. I've taken a look at some of them. One of them had 7 followers, and according to the Digital Forensic Research Lab, was dedicated to celebrating the beauty of African women. But then we started to see Venezuela Analysis, one of the most important left-wing sites dedicated to covering Venezuela and Latin America from a socialist and anti-imperialist perspective, taken off Facebook for no reason. Then we saw Telesur, which is funded by socialist-oriented Latin American governments and is a really important news agency, taken off Facebook for no reason at the same time. And this all occurred 2 days after an assassination attempt on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. I'm not saying there's a connection there, but the timing was very interesting. And Venezuela Analysis had actually produced a really important post criticizing the way mainstream media had covered the assassination. So it's clear there is a suppression attempt taking place on Facebook, targeting particularly left-wing dissident news outlets and activists, also targeting people on the right. And I think what we are witnessing is a gradual regression and rollback, not of free speech, but of our ability to dissent on Silicon Valley platforms that are susceptible to U.S. government pressure.
Along the lines of censorship and taking objectionable or vile and potentially dangerous information off the internet, Alex Jones has been targeted. Alex Jones InfoWars has promoted this vile notion that Newtown parents were faking their children's death in the Sandy Hook massacre. And there has been lawsuits against Alex Jones that are playing out in court. But what I wanted to ask you was that there are a whole raft of very objectionable things on our internet, Holocaust deniers, people preaching white supremacy, neo-Nazis, Klansmen, and the like. What is the danger of abrogating free speech on the internet and putting someone in charge of censorship of all manner of political viewpoints, whether they be on the right or the left?
Well, I feel about as warmly towards Alex Jones as you do. So I somehow find him amusing, and you know, I like laughing at him. But I also think, you know, he is a racist and he is spreading misinformation in a really cynical way in order to increase his profit margin. He's the worst kind of huckster that America has produced in the last decade or so. And people really need to question the long-term consequences of banning someone like Alex Jones. It was unfortunate to me to see so many progressives celebrate him being banned and then not being able to understand why legitimate news sites on the left were then banned days later. This isn't going to be limited to Alex Jones. So I think it's important to look at the long-term consequences of letting established forces decide what we should see and hear on what have unfortunately become our digital commons, which is Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and social media platforms like those.
That was journalist and author Max Blumenthal, editor of thegrayzoneproject.com. Learn more about the threat of political censorship on social media by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Opponents of gas and oil pipelines across the U.S. have been fighting in the courts, in the streets, and in the treetops. One controversial pipeline, called Mariner East 2, was touted by its owners, Sunoco Logistics and Energy Transfer Partners, as the answer to Europe's need for more liquefied natural gas, or LNG. But to transport the LNG in tankers across the Atlantic Ocean, Big Oil needed a pipeline to move fracked gas from the Pennsylvania heartland to the Marcus Hook refinery on the Delaware River. That's where, in 2015, the pipeline companies crossed paths with the Gerhardt family, who had established a homestead in central Pennsylvania as a haven for native plants and animals over 35 years. The pipeline developers wanted an easement to build their pipeline across the Gerhardts' property, but the family said no, so the companies eventually took it through eminent domain. There were battles in court, and when it became clear they wouldn't find justice there, that was followed by opponents engaging in nonviolent tree sits along the pipeline route to block construction. On July 27th, Ellen Gerhardt, a 63-year-old retired teacher and grandmother, was arrested and had her bail set at $25,000 cash. She was convicted by the judge of indirect criminal contempt and sentenced to 2 to 6 months in prison. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Elise Gerhardt, Ellen's daughter, who's been fighting the pipeline along with her mother. Together, they set up Camp White Pine on their property as a focus for their resistance. Here she discusses her mother's case and the damage that the pipeline has already done to the surrounding property.
Their complaint that they put into the Huntington County Court, that they submitted to the Huntington County Court, just making all these wild sort of allegations against her, saying that she was threatening them and that she had basically made a bomb threat or something to our Huntington County emergency manager, when in reality what she did was sent him an email expressing her concerns about safety with the pipeline and about the potential for leaks and explosions. And like, she wanted to talk to him about what the emergency response plan is in the county if something were to happen, because these things do happen. Like, we've seen them happen. There's just that TransCanada line that exploded in West Virginia not that long ago. Here in Pennsylvania, we had a bad explosion on Texas Eastern back in April 2016, and you know, man was badly burned, and these things happen.
Elise Gerhardt, what was your mom actually convicted of?
She was convicted of indirect criminal contempt. In the courtroom, they were trying to bring in all these other things they were accusing her of doing, and then sort of chalking it all up to saying, like, and all these things mean that she's interfering with the pipeline, and therefore we're sending her to jail because the judge previously ruled that the pipeline could use any domain on her property and that she was not allowed to interfere with them doing that. But the way they do that is through this long process of trying to criminalize her bit by bit, like taking away her property rights and then criminalizing her under various Pennsylvania statutes. So, I mean, the whole thing has been like a legal mess, and it's been really strange to kind of combat, because there's not a whole lot of precedent with trying to do this, with like trying to fight eminent domain and then direct action to try and fight when that fails. I mean, really, my mom should not be in jail for doing some things on her own property because theoretically these guys shouldn't even be on her property.
Right.
They shouldn't be around to, like, see any of the bears that are already here, regardless of whether we're here or not. There'd probably be a lot more bears here if we weren't here. You know, we've lived with them for 30 years. And so now, yeah, Sunoco's complaining because they saw a bear on the easement that they made. You know, it's just such a weird twist they're putting on the whole situation. Like, we live in the woods. They come to our house. They destroy the land. They muddy up the water. And then they throw the property owner in jail because she keeps speaking out against them.
Right.
Letting them know that she does not give them consent to do these things. That's really all she's done, is just continue to assert her rights and say, you guys don't have the right to come in here and wreak havoc in my life and destroy the environment that I've tried to protect by, like, stewarding this land. Like, that's the way my mom sees it. Like, she's been taking care of this plot of land for the past 35 years. The Monday after she was arrested, there was a hearing about whether or not she could have bail. And the judge decided to hold her on $25,000 bail, cash bail, so you couldn't even pay 10% to get her out. We would need literally $25,000 to get her out. So there was a claim of that she was baiting mountain lions, right, in addition to bears. And there are no mountain lions in Pennsylvania these days. Like, the Game Commission, their official position is that there haven't been mountain lions in this area since the 30s. So the judge said in court, I think that mountain lions are extinct. And then he proceeded to revoke her bail, hold her on $25,000, and then the following Friday sentenced her to 2 to 6 months in jail based on Sunoco's claim that could easily be disproven.
Do you know how close to finish the pipeline is?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Originally, the pipeline was supposed to be completed in November of 2016, but because people worked together to fight the permitting and then just a lot of, like, incompetence on ATP's part when it comes to construction, like, all the spills and stuff that have happened while they're doing construction have happened because they didn't even know what they were getting themselves into with the geology of Pennsylvania, and they've just been trying to, you know, pound it through and into people's private water supplies, busting into aquifers, in mountains, dumping drilling fluid into rivers and all this stuff. Like, it's just been a disaster.
That was Elise Gerhard, daughter of imprisoned Mariner East pipeline opponent, 63-year-old Ellen Gerhard. Gerhard has a criminal trial scheduled in late August on charges of harassment. Learn more about the campaign opposing construction of the Mariner East 2 pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Inmates in at least 17 states across the U.S. launched a prison strike to end slavery on August 21st. The action is set to go through September 9th, the date of the 1971 Attica prison uprising that left 43 dead. In a press release, an inmate group called Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, which organized the strike, said their action was in response to the April 15th riot in Lee Correctional Institution, a maximum security prison in South Carolina, where 7 inmates were killed in violence that activists said could have been avoided were it not for overcrowded conditions and a lack of respect for human life. During the strike, prisoners are being encouraged to stop reporting for work assignments, while others may engage in hunger strikes, all with the goal of calling attention to what many behind bars view as the exploitative conditions in American prisons today. Striking inmates put forward a list of 10 demands, including a call for prisoners to be paid prevailing hourly wages, funding for rehabilitation programs, sentencing reform, educational opportunities, and the restoration of voting rights. Your reporter spoke with Ed Mead, former director of the Prison Art Project, former co-editor of Prison Focus, and a one-time political prisoner. Here he discusses how the nationwide strike to end prison slavery came about and ongoing efforts to legislate prison reforms and to protect human rights behind bars.
The 7 prisoners were killed in one of the Carolina prison systems. And those are the prisoners that called for the national prison strike. Now, last year, the call was put out by prisoners in Alabama and was pretty successful by anybody's standards. Before that, several years, actually, I think it was as far back as 2010, prisoners in Georgia managed to pull off a statewide 5-day prison work strike. It was crushed after 5 days, and none of their demands were met. And then we have the case in California that started in 2013, a series of hunger strikes by prisoners there. The first strike, and according to the Department of Corrections of California, involved 6,600 prisoners. The second strike, very close to 12,000 prisoners. And the third and final strike, and here I have to emphasize that these are not figures put out by prisoners. These are figures put out by the California Department of Corrections to the news media. There were 30,000 prisoners participating in a hunger strike and 2,600 refusing to go to work. So what's happening here is there is a budding prisoners' movement. And so the window is open for change, and this window, it might take 5 years, it might take 10 years, it might take 20 years. But the essence of this struggle is to eliminate slavery. Most people don't know that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery with one exception, and that is except as punishment for crime, whereas the person has been, duly convicted. And so we have 2.2 million slaves in the United States, and they are treated as such. And actually, until not too long ago, the courts held that what they call the hands-off doctrine, that prisoners have no rights that the state is bound to respect, not too unlike the Dred Scott decision a long time ago.
Ed, what do we know about prisoners who've been organizing behind the walls across the country? What kinds of actions have been undertaken by prisoners inside by way of strikes, passive or active resistance? What's been happening inside?
Right. First of all, it's a little premature because when prisoners often, when they go on work strike, the prison administration says, oh, it's a lockdown. They're not on strike. We've locked them down. And it takes a little bit of time for the word to leak out as to what's going on in various prisons. The Guardian and the New York Times, for example, said there are 17 states in protest on strike. But that article did not include the states of Washington and California. And there are prisons here and there that are protesting. So we don't really, we can't get a fair number at this point.
Ed, before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you this question. In recent years, we've seen some bridge building between Democrats and Republicans on the issue of sentencing reform and prison reform, although there really has been no substantive success in passing major legislation in that direction. What is your hope that Democrats and Republicans in Congress can come together to make some headway towards reform of our system?
I have no hope. What's going to change this is the same thing that changed gay marriage, and the same thing is in the process of changing marijuana laws, and that is an upsurge of resistance by prisoners themselves. The Congress has had over 200 years to do something about this, and they haven't. And all their talk is just that. The people themselves, those who are involved, have to be their own liberators, have to bring about the process of change. They can't wait for the benevolent state to do that for them because it will never happen. It never has and it never will.
The date that this prison strike, this current prison strike, was launched was August 21st. The end date is September 9th. Those two dates are significant, both for the death of George Jackson, who died in 1971 on that date, and Attica. But tell our listeners about the significance of those two dates, if you would.
George Jackson was a prison leader at San Quentin and was gunned down, was killed by prison guards. And that set off I guess you'd call it a riot at Attica Prison in New York. The state suppressed that by killing 43 people, just firing into the prison yard on unarmed prisoners at the order of Governor Rockefeller. And so those two dates are significant for prisoners.
That was Ed Mead, longtime prison reform activist, former co-editor of Prison Focus, and one-time political prisoner. His autobiography is titled Lumpin'. Learn more about the nationwide strike to end prison slavery by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Karee Brittum's Radio in Atlanta, Georgia, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KSKQ in Ashland, Oregon, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Bipartisanship, as in the nation's two corporate political parties working together to get things done. One hears this mostly from corporate media elites or intellectuals who decry the lack of civility in today's politics. What does this mean in the real world? A plaintiff plea that politicians play nicer. In practice, however, it really means that they unite before their funders to bequeath more and more of the nation's wealth on them. For the poor, the impoverished, the immigrant, and the oppressed, it really means more war on them. For the wealthy elites ever love disunion among the people between irrelevancies like race, ethnicity, and social rank. They have ever and always tried to use race, language, age, and other perceived differences to drive workers at each other's throats. They have ever stoked fear of the other to secure their class ascendancy. That's the lesson of Trumpism, but he is not alone in this. Do you oppose Trump because of his racist, fear-mongering call for the wall? On April 23rd, 2006, the New York Daily News published an article quoting Hillary Clinton, saying we need a wall. Immigrant wars, it seems, are bipartisan. For both corporate parties utilize fear to drive voters. Bipartisan politics brought us NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the AEDPA, the so-called Effective Death Penalty Act, the Chinese Exclusion Act, and so much more. Bipartisanship equals repression amid the toothy smiles of political jackals. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Immigration. More specifically, the issue has been American anxiety about the rising tide of immigrants, especially Mexican or other non-white immigrants. Several days ago, I've been reading No One is Illegal by Justin Akers Chacon and Mike Davis, published by Haymarket Books. I've learned new things on virtually every page, especially the harrowing history of how the U.S. treated immigrants over the years. The history of the U.S. is largely seen by the demand for workers from China, Japan, the Philippines, and later Mexicans. They would be invited, welcomed, super exploited by growers, and then they were demonized by politicians and media to be assaulted, insulted, and deported. These workers were paid a mere pittance. Some, like Chinese, were spit on in the street by white ruffians and vigilantes. Some were beaten. Some were killed. When Mexicans came north to take these jobs, some by way of the U.S. Bracero program, they were isolated and separated from others so that they could more easily be exploited. They were signed up to work by contract. And once that ended, they were deported back home to Mexico. They essentially feed the U.S. nation for pennies, only to be demonized, isolated, and forbidden to join unions. The hardest working get the lowest wages. Sound familiar? The struggles of migrant workers in the U.S. are truly eye-opening. It ain't pretty, but it gives us a lot to learn. That U.S. history ain't shown at the movies. Those stories have yet to be told. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM out of Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota. This program is produced in partnership with the Center for Research on Globalization, where our programs are available for download. We are also aired on several community and internet stations across Canada and the United States. My name is Michael Welch. This week, on the occasion of the anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, we bring you a special documentary entitled The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. This feature was put together in 2004 by longtime Canadian journalist and media critic Barry Zwicker. It encapsulates one of the best analyses up to that point, critiquing the official explanation of the attacks of September 11th, 2001. Zwicker has referred to the 9/11 attacks as the linchpin in the entire edifice of the war on terrorism and makes the point that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and their draconian legislation restricting suspected terrorists at home would not have been possible without that signature event. It took a remarkable 411 days after the attacks for a commission of inquiry to be called, which at the end of the day reinforced the idea that 9/11 was a sneak attack that caught the $40 billion a year military intelligence apparatus of the United States completely off guard. What follows is an edited version of this documentary. It is available free of charge on YouTube. Here is Barry Zwicker with The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw, on the Global Research News Hour.
The so-called war on terrorism justifies the mounting deaths of U.S. soldiers and civilians in Iraq and elsewhere, justifies the little publicized construction of giant new U.S. military bases overseas, and is the basis for the doctrine of preemptive war, contrary to international law and basic morality. It's responsible for grotesquely ballooning deficits to pay for all this, debts being passed on to coming generations, and plans for even more expenditures on terror-fighting bureaucracies. The so-called war on terror is cited as the ultimate basis for sharp increases in domestic spying and reduction in freedoms and civil liberties at home and attempts to criminalize dissent. All this because the official authorized truth is that foreign terrorists attacked the USA on 9/11. As we tape this in the summer of 2004, fear grows as authorities and pundits predict more terrorist events on the scale of 9/11 or greater. The I word, inevitable, is increasingly used. The designated scapegoats of 9/11 gained nothing positive from it. On the other hand, even the hardliners in Washington themselves agree 9/11 boosted their agenda. Who benefits from more of the same? The fear campaign, always resting on the official 9/11 story, looks deliberate. Again, What if the official story of 9/11 is a big lie? You probably don't know, if you're trapped inside the cocoon spun by the North American media industry, that there is, in fact, widespread skepticism about who was behind 9/11. 30% of Germans, according to reliable polls, think the U.S. government had a hand in it. They remember that big Reichstag deception. This poll done in Canada in May 2004 showed 63% of Canadians think individuals within the U.S. government, including the White House, had prior knowledge of the plans for the events of September 11th and failed to take appropriate action to stop them. In this program, we present some of the accumulating evidence indicating that lying behind the great deception of 9/11 is the great conspiracy of 9/11. But first, more historical context. When we come back, three true stories of fake attacks on America.
Let's find out about despotism. This man makes it his job to study these things.
Well, for one thing, avoid the comfortable idea that the mere form of government can of itself safeguard a nation against despotism.
Welcome back to The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. If 9/11 is a big lie, a fake attack, an inside job, is it unique? No, quite the reverse. Most war-triggering incidents are great deceptions. The Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, the attack on Pearl Harbor, all involved secretly contrived attacks on Americans planned or encouraged by American presidents. The Vietnam War and Desert Storm in 1991 also were triggered by deceptions involving U.S. presidents. If 9/11 is not such a deception, it's an exception to the rule. Most people want peace most of the time. That's a problem for rulers bent on war. History teaches that rulers arranging for their country to be attacked, or appear to be attacked, is the fastest method for these rulers to get their way when they want war. Consider only three cases, starting with this book, Body of Secrets. Author James Bamford is a former Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. I learned of this book on ABC's website. Bamford's information comes from interviews with, for instance, the former dean of the U.S. intelligence community, and from government documents. It takes 80 pages to list Bamford's more than 600 information sources. Here's the story. It's 1962. John F. Kennedy is U.S. president, Robert McNamara is Secretary of Defense, and Admiral Lyman Lemnitzer heads the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. The CIA fails in its illegal Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. JFK decides, Bamford writes, to back away from military solutions to the Cuban problem. But Lemnitzer, the CIA, and others at the top remain obsessed with Cuba. Writes Bamford, as the Kennedy brothers appeared to suddenly go soft on Cuba, Lemnitzer could see his opportunity to invade quickly slipping away. Attempts to provoke the Cuban public to revolt seemed dead. Lemnitzer and the other chiefs knew there was only one option left that would ensure their war. They would have to trick the American public and world opinion. Lemnitzer comes up with Operation Northwoods. We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. Casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation. We could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington. An elaborate variation. Create an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft. At a designated time, the duplicate would be loaded with selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted to a drone, a remotely controlled unmanned aircraft. The destruction of that aircraft will be triggered by radio signal. The Cubans would be blamed. Finally, another variation is described by Bamford. On February the 20th, 1962, John Glenn was to lift off from Cape Canaveral on his historic journey. Lemnitzer proposed that should the rocket explode and kill Glenn, the objective is to provide irrevocable proof that the fault lies with Cuba by manufacturing various pieces of evidence which would prove electronic interference on the part of the Cubans. Thus, Bamford notes, as NASA prepared to send the first American into space, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were preparing to use John Glenn's possible death as a pretext to launch a war. The Operation Northwoods plan shows the Pentagon was capable, according to Bamford, of launching a secret and bloody war of terrorism against their own country in order to trick the American public into supporting a war on Cuba. In light of this, does Pentagon complicity in the events of September 11th sound entirely far-fetched? Now, fast forward just 2 years from Operation Northwoods to August 2nd, 1964. In the Gulf of Tonkin, North Vietnamese torpedo boats attack the U.S. destroyer Maddox. The Associated Press story, for some reason, is datelined Pearl Harbor. The lead: three PT boats, identified by Secretary of State Dean Rusk as North Vietnamese, attacked. Later, a second U.S. destroyer is attacked, according to news reports. Although no U.S. sailor suffers a scratch, the American public is outraged. President Lyndon Johnson goes on television to ask the country to support war action. 2 days later, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution is approved by the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously, then by the Senate 88-2. The resolution becomes the entire justification for the United States war against Vietnam. Before that's over, 58,000 American soldiers and 3 million Vietnamese die. One small problem. There never were any North Vietnamese PT boats. The events never happened. As Secretary of State Rusk, the President, and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara well know. They know because they plan the entire deception. One source for this is former Admiral James Stockdale in his book, In Love and War. On the night in question, Stockdale is at the controls of a fighter jet flying cover for the two destroyers. He sees nothing. Another source is Ben Bradley, much respected former managing editor of the Washington Post. Bradley, in a public lecture in England in April 1987, states, "The facts behind this critically important resolution were quite simply lies." Fast forward again to August 2, 1990. Iraq attacks Kuwait, claiming the Kuwaitis are slant drilling into Iraq's oil fields. U.S. President George Herbert Walker Bush pushes for a land war against Iraq, but polls show the U.S. public is split 50-50 on that idea. Then comes this eyewitness testimony before a congressional committee from a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl. The claim is she cannot be identified for fear of reprisals.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
The U.S. public is outraged. The result? Support for land war zooms. It's a turning point. Desert Storm is launched. 135,000 Iraqis are killed. An estimated 1 million Iraqis, many of them children and old people, then die as a result of 10 years of sanctions. One small problem. There never were any incubator baby deaths, not one. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's investigative flagship program, The Fifth Estate, reveals the girl to be the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, given her lines and coached in acting by the giant American PR firm Hill & Knowlton. It's one phase in a $10 million joint U.S.-Kuwaiti campaign of deception. This man is lying.
I myself buried 14 newborn babies that had been taken from their incubators.
This man is lying.
And they had kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
There were a lot of people who participated in a conspiracy. Yes, an out-and-out conspiracy of fake organizations, false documents, fraud, and disinformation. So, if a new man named Bush is in the White House and helps engineer a brazen deception, in order to achieve global geopolitical goals, as well as domestic and personal ones, it wouldn't be a first, would it? After a short break, a detailed look at the events of September 11th, 2001.
Today, democracy can ebb away in communities whose citizens allow power to become concentrated in the hands of bosses.
What I say goes, see? I'm the law around here.
The test of despotic power is that it can disregard the will of the people.
Welcome back to The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. The events of 9/11 begin with aircraft going wildly off course. Incredibly, despite radar tracking for almost 2 hours, the whole of the mighty U.S. Air Force goes AWOL that morning. It's a mind-bending anomaly. Not a single U.S. Air Force interceptor turns a wheel until it's too late. There are no jets at all. It's a matter of historical record. That could happen only two ways. Either it was staggering multiple simultaneous coincidental incompetence at all levels in many agencies defying known laws of averages, a 54 million to one chance, which is the 9/11 Commission official story. There's another explanation. The U.S. Air Force is neutralized by design. The evidence indicates this is about a 1-to-1 chance. Standard procedures for dealing with aviation emergencies of all kinds have been in place and have worked for years. David Ray Griffin is the author of The New Pearl Harbor, the most widely respected critique of the official story of 9/11. He quotes the Federal Aviation Authority's Aeronautical Information Manual, Official Guide to Basic Flight Information and Air Traffic Control, ATC, procedures. It states, if you are in doubt that a situation constitutes an emergency or potential emergency, handle it as though it were an emergency. As for the military, the guiding document is ACC 113-SAOC, Volume 3, U.S. Air Defense Command and Control Operations. At the top of the first page, it reads, compliance with this order is mandatory. The first paragraph reads, in part, the ADC, Air Defense Command, is to provide North American Aerospace Defense Command with the means to detect, monitor, identify, intercept, report, and if necessary, destroy any airborne object that may pose a threat to North America in the fulfillment of the Tactical Threat Warning Attack Assessment and to provide such information to collateral missions of NORAD. Michael Rupert, a former Los Angeles Police Department detective, was the first major 9/11 skeptic and researcher in the world, and remains one of the foremost. He was one of 40 experts on 9/11 who testified at the six-day International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11, held in Toronto in May of 2004. I helped organize that event. At the inquiry, Michael Rupert addresses the absence of jet interceptors, but the unlikelihood of a simple stand-down order, and asks,
what if they were so confused and had been so deliberately confused that they couldn't respond?
Michael Rupert is standing by at his office in Sherman Oaks, California. Michael, thanks for this. What is the reason for the failure of U.S. military jets to show up in a timely fashion on 9/11?
Well, the simple fact is, Barry, that they didn't know where to go. The reason that they didn't know where to go was because a number of conflicting and overlapping war game exercises were taking place, one of which Northern Vigilance had pulled a significant number of North American fighter aircraft into Canada and Western Alaska and Northern Alaska in a mock Cold War hijack exercise. There was another drill, Vigilant Guardian, which was a hijack exercise, a command post exercise, but it involved the insertion of false radar blips under radar screens in the Northeast Air Defense Sector. In addition, we have a confirmation, thanks to General Richard Myers, who was acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who told Richard Clark, as reported in Clark's book, that there was another exercise, Vigilant Warrior, which was, in fact, according to a NORAD source, a live-fly hijack drill being conducted at the same time. With only 8 available fighter aircraft, and they have to be dispatched in pairs, they were dealing with as many as 22 possible hijacks on the day of 9/11, and they couldn't separate the war game exercises from the actual hijacks.
But this was done deliberately, though.
Apparently so, and I will be saying that in my forthcoming book, Crossing the Rubicon, 9/11 and the Decline of American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. We have done an extensive investigation on that to show that these war game exercises were apparently very well planned by someone who I will show, I believe, was Dick Cheney in the United States government to deliberately confuse FAA, NORAD, and U.S. Air Force fighter response to fulfill a prophecy that another man had once said, let one happen and stop the rest.
On that very point, we have a recording.
All right, Boston Center, TMU, we have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York. We need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Now, the 9/11 Commission didn't mention the war games, is that right?
No, in their final report, they did mention, I think, in one paragraph, Vigilant Guardian, but the response given by NORAD Commanding General Ralph Eberhardt and other Air Force spokespeople was absolutely nonsensical, and it made no mention of any of the other war game exercises. Eberhardt's position was, in fact, which is a very ludicrous position, that the Vigilant Guardian exercise, leaving aside the others, actually helped speed response on 9/11, and that is absolutely not the case.
How does this relate to the 9/11 Commission report, which says that planes had gone in the wrong directions?
Well, that's a separate issue, and that remains to be clarified. But what I will be disclosing in my book, in effect, is that there were two simultaneously operating command and control systems functioning on the day of 9/11, and at some times they were issuing conflicting orders. We do not have a clear explanation for why fighters from Andrews Air Force Base were sent out over the sea first and couldn't turn around, because the 9/11 Commission seemed to change all the evidence just arbitrarily right before it issued its final report. So we don't have a clear explanation, but certainly there was all consistent with a motive that said make sure that the fighters don't get to any place in time to stop the three critical attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
I have called that in my own research an effective stand down. Would you say that would be a correct characterization?
Well, it is a de facto stand down. That was the intended result. I would really call it an intended paralysis. With only 8 available fighters, and fighters have to be scrambled in pairs, you only had a chance for 4 responses out of what we have confirmed were as many as 22 possible hijacks showing up on radar screens.
That is fascinating and damning information. I look forward to your book. What about the motivation for the whole of 9/11?
Well, overall, the primary motivation was something we call peak oil, the fact that the world has either passed or is at now its permanent peak of hydrocarbon or oil production, and now about to go into a condition of permanent and irrevocable decline in oil production, even as demand is soaring exponentially, both in the West and in China, Asia, and the developing countries. This has set off what we at From the Wilderness, and certainly in my book, we will describe as a very bitter sequence of conflicts, as Dick Cheney told us, in the war that will not end in our lifetimes, to secure the last remaining oil reserves on the planet. We've seen a lot of other instances where this kind of attack was predicted and stated as a requirement for the American empire to mobilize its military resources. Zbigniew Brzezinski did in his book, The Grand Chessboard, in 1997. The Project for a New American Century called for a new Pearl Harbor in 1992. So there is, there's a lot of evidence here showing very clearly that this attack was needed. It was planned, and all of the evidence that has been so diligently compiled has just been absolutely ignored by the Keene Commission.
And finally, Michael, I certainly, for one, accept your motive of peak oil. What about other motives that could be involved?
Well, if you are going to, as Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote, he said some kind of direct external threat, an attack like Pearl Harbor. Basically, he said you have to scare the bejesus out of the American people to get them to support the, quote, imperial mobilization, those were his words, necessary to secure these vital resources in these strategic geopolitical regions on the planet. Without that, the American people would never have gone for it. And, of course, now in late 2004, we are beginning to see that the American people aren't going along with it now either.
Michael, thank you for this today.
Bye-bye, Barry.
Dr. Robert M. Bowman is a veteran of 122 combat missions in Vietnam. His 22-year Air Force career culminated in his job as Director of Advanced Space Programs Development for the Air Force Space Division during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. He's president of the Institute for Space and Security Studies. His presentation to the Citizens Inquiry was titled, A Fighter Pilot Looks Back at 9/11 and Forward to a Resurrected America.
9/11 is related to just about everything else, particularly the war against Iraq. These two things have one aspect very much in common. They are both, in my opinion, treason. The cabal of neoconservatives at PNAC, I think you all know what that is, who planned this war, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Libby, Pearl, Jeb Bush, even before W became president, I don't say elected, I say became president, this cabal knew the American people would not stand for a war against Iraq unless there was, as they put it in their own document, a new Pearl Harbor. 9/11 supplied that.
In other words, 9/11 was a false flag operation. That's one term to describe an act carried out to make it appear it was done by someone else. Next, the man who's written the book on false flag operations. Webster Tarpley is an historian and journalist based in Washington, D.C. He has studied the dark world of intrigue, peopled by patsies, paid killers known as operators, and moles, government officials who flout their own country's laws. He made two presentations to the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11. They are uncompromisingly titled The 9/11 Terror Fraud, A Coup Against Civilization.
Now here I would submit is a very important diagram that I commend to your attention, and I want to tarry and look at it for a moment. We are dealing with state-sponsored false flag terrorism. I don't mean state-sponsored in the sense that it has to be sponsored by the entire command structure of the country in question, but that it is carried forward by a private network ensconced and infesting decisive nodal points in the state apparatus of that country. I'll try to show you what I mean. Here we have to distinguish a world of patsies, the people that you hear about. I'll try to show you some of this in detail. The people we can call the dupes, the useful idiots, the fanatics, the police agents, the double agents, the provocateurs, in short, the Oswalds, the fall guys. Lee Harvey Oswald, I'm just a patsy, direct quote. That's one group. The moles. This is the group of government officials, the network of government officials whose loyalty is not to the command structure, the Constitution, or their country in some diffuse sense, but rather their loyalty goes to a private intelligence network, a private clique faction, a group of putschists, if you will, people trying to have a coup d'etat. You also have to distinguish the professional killers. These are the cold-blooded technicians of murder. This is the sort of area where you see retired veterans of the Special Forces, the Delta Force, the CIA Operations Directorate, and so on down the line. the old boys. At the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, the term for this group in Washington was the asteroids. Finally, the corporate media. They are the indispensable ingredient, because without them, you can't have anything. You have to have mass propaganda to accredit and spread and pound the official version of the events into the minds of people, and to smooth over the inevitable absurdities, contradictions, impossibilities, and so forth of the official story. Mass brainwashing in the Anglo-American tradition is what they propose.
You're watching The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. When we come back, the classic question. What did the president know about 9/11, and when did he know it?
This is the Global Research News Hour, broadcast on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is also available for download on the site globalresearch.ca. And you're listening to The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw, by host and producer Barry Zwicker.
Welcome back to The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. What did George Bush know about the events of 9/11, and when did he know them? I'm not asking what George Bush, or Bill Clinton for that matter, knows or should have known in the weeks or years before, based on this or that so-called intelligence report that he sees or should have seen about vague or not so vague alleged terrorist threats. No, my questions are much more restricted. I'm asking what specific advance information George W. Bush has about the first plane hitting the World Trade Center before it strikes. How does he get that information, and from whom? Why does he act as if he has far less information than the record shows he must have had? Initial news reports show the president informed of the gravity of the situation that morning. That famous whisper in the ear must be put into context. It takes place at 9:05. That's 1 hour and 5 minutes after the first hijacking. 45 minutes after the FAA is aware of multiple errant airliners, 20 minutes after the first aircraft smashes into the Trade Center, 18 minutes after CNN breaks into regular programming. In other words, a torrent of hot water churns under the bridge before whisper time. Researchers Jared Israel and Ilarion Baikov of emperorsclothes.com write shortly after 9/11. The President of the United States travels with an entire staff, including the Secret Service, which is responsible for his safety. The members of this support team have the best communications equipment in the world. They maintain contact with, or can easily reach, Bush's cabinet, the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon, the FAA. Information concerning these alarming events must be shared with the President by his staff, otherwise they would be derelict in their duties. Not surprising, then, this report by ABC's John Cochrane, traveling with the president, here speaking to Peter Jennings, not long after the president left his hotel. Peter, as you know, the president's down in Florida talking about education. He got out of his hotel suite this morning, was about to leave. Reporters saw the White House chief of staff, Andy Card, whisper into his ear. The reporter said to the president, "Do you know what's going on in New York?" He said he did. And he said he will have something about it later. His first event is in about half an hour at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. Something is very odd about the president's behavior. The president is aware, by his own words, that something serious is happening in New York. He additionally has to be aware of a great deal more about the situation. You have John Ashcroft later in the day at a press conference.
Immediately after the first report of a plane crashing into the World Trade Towers, numerous federal agencies coordinating with the White House mobilized their resources.
You have Vice President Dick Cheney, September 16th on NBC's Meet the Press. He tells host Tim Russert, "The Secret Service has an arrangement with the FAA. They had open lines after the World Trade Center was..." Then he stops himself. You have Laura Brown of the FAA. She attends hearings of the 9/11 Commission that bear on the aviation aspects of the day. Embarrassed by previous non-forthcoming testimony about the FAA's role, she sends an email in May of 2003 to members of the media whose business cards she had collected. Within minutes after the first aircraft hit the World Trade Center, she states in her email, the FAA immediately established several phone bridges that included FAA field facilities, the FAA command center, FAA headquarters, DOD, the Secret Service, and other government agencies. The U.S. Air Force liaison to the FAA immediately joined the FAA headquarters phone bridge and established contact with NORAD on a separate line. The FAA shared real-time information on the phone bridges about the unfolding events, including information about loss of communication with aircraft, loss of transponder signals, unauthorized changes in course, and other actions being taken by all the flights of interest, including Flight 77. So, in light of all this, here's the odd thing about George Bush's behavior. He and his staff could cancel or postpone an easily postponable photo op. But they don't. Why? On 9/11, Bush acts, and I emphasize acts, as if he doesn't know, as if he's not in touch. He proceeds with, or feigns, normality. Now to something else that's puzzling. At a town hall session in Orlando, Florida, on December the 4th, 2001, here's the president's own account of the early morning of 9/11.
How did you feel when you heard about the terrorist attack?
Well, thank you, Jordan. Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on.
The president tells us he sees, on an ordinary TV set outside a school classroom, the first plane hit the World Trade Center. He gives the oddly reinforcing detail that, quote, the TV was obviously on, unquote. He continues,
I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it.
Didn't have time to think about it. As if his being told, time to meet the kids, Mr. President, stops all his thought processes concerning the remarkable image of what he's told us he's just seen on an ordinary TV, on top of all his knowledge of the unprecedented situation from earlier in the morning. But anyway, could George Bush have seen, on ordinary TV, the first plane hit the World Trade Center? No, he could not have. The footage of that first strike only shows up on television the next day, September the 12th, 2001. It was taken by a French documentary crew that happened to be in downtown New York. The Orlando Town Hall session takes place 7 weeks after 9/11, so it can be suggested Bush confuses the second plane with the first. But how to explain this? We've all seen Andy Card do that. None of this can ever be retracted. It is an interlocking historical record. Why go on at length about this? Because it may one day become the basis for criminal court proceedings. When we come back, is George Bush one of a group of conspirators involved with the attack? Welcome back to The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. George Bush is very convincing that he saw the first plane strike the World Trade Center the morning of 9/11 on regular TV. He provides supporting details, has repeated the story, and never retracted it. It has run on the White House website. Since he cannot have seen it on regular TV, as he claims, it is not unreasonable to conclude that he sees the first plane on private, closed-circuit TV earlier that morning or in a private holding room later. Either way, I submit this could mean that someone had to arrange for cameras to be positioned and rolling to record the first plane strike. Those involved had to know precisely that the first plane was in the air, where and when the plane would hit. In other words, people closely associated with the President of the United States had very specific prior knowledge of the existence of the first plane, its destination, and its purpose. More clues. Bush's itinerary is well known. There are plenty of live news media reports concerning the President's whereabouts from the time he gets up that morning in his hotel until the time he arrives at Booker Elementary School, and how long it will take him to get there. Remember ABC's John Cochran and the half hour? Yet, the Secret Service, for at least a full half hour after he is notified that America is under attack, takes no steps to remove the president to safety. What happens instead? This footage also appears in Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11. No one claims this footage is doctored. The president continues reading a story about a pet goat for at least 7 minutes. One columnist absurdly suggests that the president doesn't want to alarm the children. But could the president not have said, "Kids, I'm sorry, I have to excuse myself. There's some important business I have to attend to. You just carry on with your reading, you hear?" Any reasonable analysis suggests that the president and his handlers share sufficient real-time and prior knowledge of the unprecedented events of that day. The public record shows the president and his associates fail to act appropriately, that they in fact create a fiction and play-act their assigned roles. This evidence alone constitutes grounds for proceeding with an indictment on charges of conspiracy to commit treason. But if, let's be dogged here, if the official story is true, and an astoundingly successful sneak attack from diabolical Muslims caught America totally off guard, then the White House surely must be highly motivated to turn heaven and earth, to use one of their own favorite clichés, to investigate the events of that day as quickly and thoroughly as possible. The White House must rush to appoint a respected chairman and commissioners, give them the widest powers to call witnesses, spare no expense. Except for the Reichstag fire, that's how it's usually done. 6 days after the sinking of the Titanic, a chairman is appointed to head an investigation. 9 days after Pearl Harbor, the first of 4 investigative commissions is struck. The JFK assassination, the Challenger disaster, 7 days each. How many days after 9/11 is it that President Bush named someone to head an investigation?
This commission has been charged with a crucial task.
Call it foot dragging. And then, who does Bush appoint? He appoints Henry Kissinger. Naming Kissinger sets a new standard for cynicism, or for being out of touch, or both. A New York Times editorial suggests the choice was to contain an investigation the White House long opposed. But Kissinger at least is an expert on the date September 11th. It was on that day in 1973 that the CIA-assisted overthrow of the democratically elected government of Chile takes place, masterminded by Kissinger for Richard Nixon. President Salvador Allende is murdered. In his 2001 book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, Christopher Hitchens notes Kissinger as a crucial figure at all stages of this crime and cover-up. Now, this is in reference to a bloody and unnecessary Kissinger-driven episode in Indochina, which cost the lives of 64 U.S. servicemen. But it also sums up Kissinger's role in the bloody Chilean operation. The cover-up is as important as the crime. The White House tries to install Kissinger, an expert at cover-ups, to head the 9/11 investigation. After a universal backlash, Kissinger backs off. Bush then names, it's 431 days now, Thomas Kane and Lee Hamilton as co-chairman. Kane's Azerbaijan oil connections and other conflicts of interest should make him ineligible from the outset. He earlier co-chairs the Homeland Security Project. Observers have noted that huge profits are to be made in the surveillance and security industries these days. The more alarmed the public, the bigger the profits. As for co-chair Lee Hamilton, Washington investigative journalist Joyce Lynn says he should be called Mr. Cover-Up. He is 0 for 4, she says, in finding any malfeasance in the 4 previous investigative commissions on which he's served. These include the Iran-Contra affair and the October surprise, which denied Jimmy Carter the presidency. The White House chooses all the commissioners. Lynn calls them key insiders rife with conflicts of interest. The White House brazenly appoints as the executive director one Dr. Philip Zelikow, a right-wing Republican hawk deeply involved in the Bush circle, a member of the Bush-Cheney transition team, and a National Security Council advisor with Condoleezza Rice under Bush 1. The editor of Vanity Fair, Graydon Carter, sums it up. The Bush White House did everything in its power to derail an open inquiry. Then, when faced with its inevitability, the president and his aides sought to limit its scope, its access, and its funding. The commission's full title is the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States. Reflecting extreme laziness in research and wording, the mainstream media keep referring to it as the Independent 9/11 Commission. This commission was about as independent from White House control and manipulation as the abused prisoners at Abu Ghraib were from their jailers. Mandate. The commission itself says, we're not out to blame anyone. In other words, accountability is not part of the mandate. Budget. In January 2003, the Bush administration allots the commission $3 million. This compares to $5 million for a 1996 commission that looked into casino gambling, and $50 million each for the inquiries into the Columbia shuttle explosion and the Clintons' failed Whitewater deal. The dollar amount is later grudgingly raised but never exceeds $15 million. The White House releases only 25% of 11,000 documents requested. It blacks out portions of the released documents, resists requests that the administration officials testify under oath, and tries to rush the commission's deadline. After a cat-and-mouse game, Bush and Cheney meet the commission. But it is behind closed doors. They refuse to testify under oath. No tape recorders are allowed. No transcript is allowed. Bush makes no opening statement, and those taking notes must submit them to security personnel. All of this is what is called in law guilty demeanor. The behavior of the White House in relation to the commission from start to finish only makes sense if the official story is a lie and the truth needs to be kept secret. The term whitewash doesn't do justice to the report of the 9/11 Commission. Omission-riddled, inventive cover-up, maybe? The Commission finds that the ultimate reason the events of 9/11 took place was a failure of imagination. They ought to know. Imagination was something the Commission had in abundance. The Commission imagines U.S. intelligence received insufficient specific warnings of an impending event. Even though CIA head George Tenet says in an unguarded moment that the system was blinking red, the Commission imagines there's nothing to go with. When we return, an American researcher on the number of published warnings.
A community rates low on an information scale when the press, radio, and other channels of communication are controlled by only a few people. And if books and newspapers and the radio are efficiently controlled, the people will read and accept exactly what the few in control want them to.
Welcome back to The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. American Paul Thompson has created the definitive timeline of events related to 9/11. It's drawn exclusively from published reports. Thompson takes almost an hour at the Toronto Citizen's Inquiry to list a fraction of the published reports dealing with early warnings.
Then in late August, so according to some news reports from Der Spiegel and Die Zeit, and it's also reported in the BBC and Haaretz in Israel. This is really interesting. Supposedly, Israel gives the U.S. a list of 19 terrorist names. So there are 19 people on the flight, and here they're giving 19 names. We don't know if they're the exact same list. But we do know, according to these reports, that 4 of the names are the same. including Nawaf al-Hazmi, Khalid al-Midar, Marwan al-Shihi, and Muhammad Atta. So these are like the big leaders of the 9/11 attack, and here Israel is saying that these people are inside the United States and planning an imminent attack. Early September, Egypt warns the U.S. saying that al-Qaeda is in the advanced stages of a, quote, significant operation, unquote, against an American target, probably within the U.S. So, you know, as an aside, remember that virtually every one of these things I've been talking about is talking about an attack inside the U.S. Remember that George Tenet said that all the information they had pointed to an attack overseas.
In the context of this program, it's important to note these warnings are from individuals, agencies, and whole governments who are obviously not in on the plot. It should be observed that in the main, the controversies over who knew what and when about the attacks are diversionary mini-dramas that reinforce the official fiction. What these individuals and agencies and governments discover are plans and patsies being prepared to play their roles.
Even if it's the most charitable explanation, and we say it was only incompetence, that incompetence was so severe. I mean, how many warnings do you need? And not only that, but it was followed after 9/11 by a cover-up. And as it's often said, it's not the crime, but it's the cover-up that, you know, that you end up going to jail for. That, you know, between the incompetence and the cover-up, that alone should lead to impeachment of President Bush and all of his top people.
Speaking of Bush and his top people, the commission imagines, page 35, that at 8:46, when Flight 11 hits the North Tower of the World Trade Center, neither the president or anyone, quote, in the White House or traveling with the president, knew that Flight 11 had been hijacked at 8:14 that morning. Wrong. The commission imagines, page 39, that as late as 9:30, quote, no one in the president's traveling party had any information that other aircraft were hijacked or missing. Wrong. The commission imagines it can get away with such claims, even though millions of people saw TV news reports about the hijackings on CNN beginning at 8:48. The 9/11 commission fails to ask many, many questions. Why, for instance, was protective cover not provided for Air Force One? The commission makes no mention of the extensive connections between the Bush and Bin Laden families. The commission imagines, and it's utterly right, that the media will fail spectacularly in their duty to notice these and other glaring omissions. The commission counts on the media failing to be skeptical or to ask probing questions. As columnist Lawrence Martin puts it, you would think that given the presidential record of duplicity, Bill Clinton on Monica, Ronald Reagan on Iran-Contra, Richard Nixon on Watergate, Lyndon Johnson on the Gulf of Tonkin, John Kennedy on the missile gap, that journalists might catch on one day, not in America. Martin adds, if media buttons weren't so easy to push, it's a safe bet that the terrorism threat wouldn't get half the airtime. Well, half the airtime would still be billions of hours. The commission imagines, and it's right again, that the New York Times will devote pages and pages of coverage to the commission's report without batting an eye at the shortcomings dealt with in this program. Subsequently, scores of New York Times stories quote the findings of the 9/11 commission as dependable truth on anything to do with 9/11. The commission imagines, and it's right on the money, that TV networks will air without question and newspapers publish without question this alleged exchange on 9/11 between the FAA's Herndon Command Center and FAA headquarters. I call it the report.
Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft?
Oh, God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Can we hold it right there? Imagine anyone, say yourself, learning of a major emergency. A neighbor calls to tell you your house is on fire. And you say, yeah, somebody's going to have to make a decision about that in probably 10 minutes. The fact is that on the morning of 9/11, there's a good chance that you leaped into action. Millions of ordinary people did. They call family and friends to turn on the TV. Many, I was one, try to get through to loved ones in New York. We find the phone system down. We call others to see if they'd gotten through. And they call us. But at FAA headquarters?
Everybody just left the room.
Yes, sir. I've noticed that. When there's a really big emergency, such as we have with the report here, key people just walk out of the room with fishing rods. When we come back, comments about the FAA and the 9/11 Commission report from David Ray Griffin, author of the book The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. Welcome back. David Ray Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor, is widely admired as the definitive critique of the official story of 9/11. Griffin has gone on to draft a critique of the report of the 9/11 Commission. Griffin concludes that the commission sets up the FAA as the fall guy to protect the U.S. military and thereby the Bush administration. In one case, the commission claims officials at FAA headquarters had to debate whether the report of a hijacked airliner with a bomb aboard was enough to justify bothering the military. The commission, says Griffin, portrays most FAA personnel as hopeless bunglers. In fact, in Griffin's words, guilty of criminal negligence of the most extreme sort. Yet, this is the same commission that says it cannot find any particular people deserving of blame. A remarkable contradiction. Another one. The commission itself points out the FAA did have one truly unprecedented task to perform that day. Namely, immediately landing thousands of aircraft in the air wherever they were. The commission agrees the FAA, and I quote, executed that unprecedented task flawlessly, unquote. Is it not strange, asks Griffin, that FAA personnel carried out this unprecedented task flawlessly and yet failed so miserably with tasks they had been performing on a regular basis? Additionally, Griffin observes, according to the commission, the U.S. military is itself blind, being wholly dependent on the FAA to inform it about what is going on in U.S. airspace. The commissioners would have us forget, as they do, the billions of dollars NORAD spent building detection systems second to none. As Thierry Messin writes in his book, Pentagate, the military, in fact, possess several very sophisticated radar monitoring systems, incomparable with the civilian systems. The website for one of these systems, called PAVE-PAWS, states it is capable of detecting and monitoring a great number of targets that would be consistent with a massive submarine-launched ballistic missile, or SLBM, attack. Are we to believe, Griffin asks, that our military's radar systems, which could simultaneously track dozens of missiles, could not track a single airliner headed for New York City? Griffin and others list several serious matters in which the 9/11 Commission shows no interest. They include the puzzling nature of the collapse of the Twin Towers. Jet fuel cannot burn hot enough to melt structural steel. Why surface-to-air missiles at the Pentagon were not triggered to protect the building. The question of what hit the Pentagon. The hole in the building was much smaller than a 757 would make. The connections between the Bush and Bin Laden families. And the startling case of World Trade Center Building Number 7. This and other overwhelming evidence ignored or explained away by the 9/11 Commission, which should be called the 9/11 Cover-Up Commission, suggests 9/11 is planned and executed at the highest levels of the U.S. government. People forget what immense powers and resources governments and shadow governments have to organize covert operations, fabricate false evidence, destroy real evidence, issue misleading statements, organize cover-ups, and generally make things happen through deploying agents, career inducements, bribery, and threats, subtle or otherwise. Governments have the powers to kill, maim, and imprison, and they use them. One example, It's the endless arrests of suspected terrorists, the vast majority eventually released without any charges being laid. On any other subject, this would create a huge outcry. And, of course, governments have the powers of propaganda, PR spin, news management, and, not least, secrecy. In the face, though, even of this overwhelming evidence, people still find reasons to remain blind to the possibility that 9/11 was an inside job. They say a conspiracy this large could not be kept secret, but most large covert operations are kept secret. People say they, meaning the Bush administration, wouldn't dare, for fear they'd be found out. As for being found out by the media, well, what's to fear so far? With knowledge comes responsibility. We, who are finding the scales falling from our eyes, must also find the courage to make our media and government accountable. Many peaceful means for doing this still exist. This is Barry Zwicker, signing off for The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw, but that I still live in hopes that you will.
That was Barry Zwicker's 2004 documentary, The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special you never saw. This documentary is available free of charge on YouTube. You can also find this audio version on the web by visiting globalresearch.ca and following the links to the latest episode of the Global Research News Hour. To send us your feedback, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com.